All right. I'm the host. My name is Jack Johnson, the host, and I'm here in Tucson. We'd like everyone to mute their phone unless they're speaking or sharing. Thank you. Okay, it's time to get started with our meeting. The meeting is being recorded. Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Codependents Anonymous. My name is Jack, and I'm a grateful recovering codependent. We are so excited to have you with us here today. Our presenters are Ken and Mary R., the founders of CODA. So let's begin by saying the CODA opening prayer. Please follow along with me. In the spirit of love and truth, we ask our higher power to guide us as we share our experience, strength, and hope. We open our hearts to the light of wisdom, the warmth of love, and to the joy of acceptance. We'll do a little housekeeping basically. This presentation is being recorded for audio playback on our website at codatucson.org. No video will be posted on this site. Please rename yourself if you wish to remain anonymous. Change the name displayed in your video box. Click on the three dots in the upper right corner of your video box and rename. We encourage the use of the first name, last initial, and where you are from. The chat, if you have technical issues, participants will only be allowed to chat with the hosts. To avoid crosstalk, all chats between participants is closed. If you are moving about or eating, please turn off your video feed to avoid distractions. Please mute your cell phone as well for that distraction. And lastly, please check out all the information available at these sites. You may take pictures of the screens at any time. Please also note that down in the chat box will be information about the 35th anniversary of CODA's conception and beginning, which will be the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, October 22nd through the 24th. If you want to take pictures of the screens, feel free to do so. So let's start with the program. I have asked Leisha to read the CODA preamble. Please unmute yourself to read. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Leisha. I'm codependent. The preamble of Codependents Anonymous. Codependents Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women whose common purpose is to develop healthy relationships. The only requirement for membership is a desire for healthy and loving relationships. We gather together to support and share with each other in a journey of self-discovery, learning to love the self. Living the program allows each of us to become increasingly honest with ourselves about our personal histories and our own codependent behaviors. We rely upon the 12 steps and 12 traditions for knowledge and wisdom. These are the principles of our program and guides to developing honest and fulfilling relationships with ourselves and others. In CODA, we each learn to build a bridge to a higher power of our own understanding, and we allow others the same privilege. This renewal process is a gift of healing for us. By actively working the program of Codependents Anonymous, we can each realize a new joy, acceptance, and serenity in our lives.
Thank you, Leisha.
Thank you, Leisha. I have asked Patty to read the welcome.
Hi, friends. I'm codependent. My name is Patty. We welcome you to Codependents Anonymous, a program of recovery from codependence where each of us may share our experience, strength, and hope in our efforts to find freedom where there's been bondage and peace where there has been turmoil in our relationships with others and ourselves. Most of us have been searching for ways to overcome the dilemmas of the conflicts in our relationships and our childhoods. Many of us were raised in families where addictions existed. Some of us were not. In neither case, we have found in each of our lives that codependence is a most deeply rooted compulsive behavior and that it is born out of our sometimes moderately, sometimes extremely dysfunctional family systems. We each have experienced in our own ways the painful trauma of the emptiness of our childhood and relationships throughout our lives. We attempted to use others, our mates, our friends, and even our children as our sole source of identity, value, and well-being, and as a way of trying to restore within us the emotional losses from our childhoods. Our histories may include other powerful addictions, which at times we have used to cope with our codependence. We've all learned to survive life, but in CODA, we are learning to live life. through applying the 12 steps and principles found in CODA to our daily lives and relationships, both present and past, we can experience a new freedom from our self-defeating lifestyles. It is an individual growth process. Each of us is growing at our own pace, and we will continue to do so as we remain open to God's will for us on a daily basis. Our sharing is our way of identification and helps us to free the emotional bonds of our past and the compulsive control of our present. No matter how traumatic your past or despairing your present may seem, there is hope for a new day in the program of Codependence Anonymous. No longer do you need to rely on others as a power greater than yourself. May you instead find here a new strength to be that which God intended, precious and free.
Thank you, Patty. CODA's 12 steps are the guiding spiritual principles of our individual recovery. I have asked Jeanette to read them. Please unmute.
Jeanette, codependent from Quebec, Canada. The 12 steps of Codependence Anonymous. 1, we admitted we were powerless over others, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood God. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7,
could somebody please mute your computer?
Oh, thank you. I think I was at 6. Oh no, the screen has changed to the traditions and I wasn't finished with the steps. Thank you. I believe I was on number 6. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought to prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood God, praying only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other codependents and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, Jeanette. I appreciate that. CODA's 12 traditions are the guiding spiritual principles of our meetings. I have asked Dorian to read them.
Yes, good morning, everyone. Dorian here, precious and free from near Seattle. Number 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon CODA unity. Number 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving higher power as expressed to our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for membership in CODA is a desire for healthy and loving relationships. 4, each group should remain autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or CODA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to other codependents who still suffer. 6, a CODA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the CODA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary spiritual aim. 7, every CODA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Codependence Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, CODA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, CODA has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the CODA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thank you for your service.
Thank you, Dorian, for reading. I would like to now like to introduce Ken and Mary, who will be our presenters today. Ken and Mary are a married couple in Phoenix, Arizona. They are the founders of CODA. Because of them, people all over the world are learning to have loving and healthy relationships since October 22nd of 1986. Thank you, Ken and Mary. Without further ado, Ken and Mary.
Thank you, Jack.
You're welcome.
We wanted to welcome you all to this workshop, Recovering a Loving Relationship with Ourselves. My name's Mary, and I'm a very grateful recovering codependent.
My name is Ken, and I am a very grateful recovering codependent, and I've been for a long time. So I'm going to start us off this morning we're going to talk a little bit. We're going to kind of walk through the steps throughout this process, and talk a lot about how do we apply the steps to our relationship with ourselves, because you know I came to learn very early on in my recovery that you know I really can't love Mary. I can act in loving ways for short periods of time, but until I love myself, I couldn't sustain it. And so I had to learn to love who I was. So I'm going to start. And
I will be back.
Okay. So having a loving relationship with ourselves can be quite confusing without some content and context and structure as to who we are. I love the first step. We admitted we were powerless over others, that our lives have become unmanageable. Or possibly when we're talking about a relationship with ourselves, we admitted we were powerless over how we treated ourselves and that our lives have become unmanageable. The last one is what I like the most, and there's still times today when I get into this, but we admitted we were powerless over what in the world does it mean to have a loving relationship with ourselves and that our lives have become unmanageable. To understand who we are, we understood it a long time ago, many years ago. We needed to determine who we are on the inside. And what does a loving relationship look like? And what is the loving relationship between? It's easy for me to say a loving relationship with Mary. But with me, who's loving who? And, many years ago, actually in the 1950s, they discovered, I won't go into the story, but they discovered that we're not crazy when we're talking to ourselves, but who, a psychiatrist asked this question, who the heck is talking to who? And he set out to develop a research project to find out who people determined, the voices were inside of who we are. And so we're going to take some time this morning to go through each of these. We could do a whole workshop. Day-long workshop on this process, but so we're going to kind of move through this fairly quickly. And on the right of the screen, it says healthy who's inside. What they discovered was that every single person they researched in the 1950s at that time had, they could identify three primary ego states, and that was the child, the parent, and the adult. And the child also included the teen. And it wasn't until I would say around 35, 40 years ago that they began to recognize that there was another ego state, and then the advent of quantum physics and brain mapping, they were able to determine that there is a fourth primary ego state we call the higher self. and which is our greater connection to what lays beyond. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. So I want to go through each of these on the right side as to how we, you know, this represents if we were in an ideal family system and we went through various stages of development, we would develop in very, ideally, very loving ways. So ideal development is on the right side, and we're born into a child ego state, basically. And it's the loving child and teen that actually carries our spontaneity, our creativity, our play, our fun, our laughter, our hopes, our dreams, our memories of everything that happened, and our feelings about each of those things. The child carries our primary feelings, the seven primary feelings of fear and shame and pain, anger, loneliness, guilt, and joy. And all other feelings, words, are derivatives of those seven. So the child and as it develops into the teen, is the most authentic part of who we are. And every other part of each ego state is there to support being who I believe my higher power intended me to be, which was spontaneous, real, authentic, vulnerable with my feelings, but with power, empowerment, which actually comes from the parent. So the parent is there to support the child. The loving adult is to gather information, and which is, the loving adult is really a laptop computer that we'll talk about in a little bit. And the higher self is a direct link and connection to our heart. And the consciousness of our heart is very different than the consciousness of our adult or intellect. So they discovered that in any given moment, one of these ego states is talking to another. And they developed a whole therapy based on it, called transactional analysis. And that was to analyze the transactions or the interactions going on inside of us. Who's talking to who? So the child, as I said, carries the play, the fun, the laughter, the freedom, the spontaneity, the creativity, the hopes, the dreams, the feelings and the memories of everything that happened to us, good, bad, and ugly. And in my case, you know, at a very young age, I started to shut that child down. I wanted to, because of the feelings that child carried, mm-hmm. shame and the guilt and the loneliness, I started to block that part of who I was to survive what was happening in my life, the trauma, forms of abuse and abandonment and enmeshment and neglect, all of which I experienced in across the board to one degree or another, emotionally, physically, sexually, intellectually, and spiritually. And so I tried to block that part of my brain. Excuse me, got some allergies going on this morning, but I tried to block that part of my brain because it hurt too much. It literally hurt too much to be a child. And so I didn't like who I was. The way I was treated by the outside world, by the authorities in my life, taught me that various toxic shame messages, I'm not enough, I don't belong, I don't fit in. One of the most key messages, toxic shame messages that I inherited from my mom was basically, what's wrong with you? She would say that all the time. What in the world is wrong with you? So I grew up believing something was horribly wrong with me. So but in ideal development, that child is nurtured, their feelings matter, their thoughts matter. Even though they may be childlike, it doesn't matter that they're childlike, they're respected. And their thoughts are respected. In ideal development, that child is treated with integrity and with dignity and with respect by the loving parent. And the loving parent is basically all we have. I don't have Mary. I don't have our kids. I don't have our grandkids. I get to enjoy time with them, but I don't have them. All I have is what you see here is I have a higher power, a loving connection to my higher self, to my higher power. I have an intellect and loving adult. I have a parent who cares for me or doesn't and a loving child. And so, ideally, a loving parent carries our boundaries. They carry our protector. They carry, I'm going to go through a list of self and then a list of various things. Self-esteem, self-confidence, self-respect, self-care, self-love, self-integrity, self-dignity, all come from that loving parent to the child. I didn't know that growing up. I didn't see it. I didn't get it. I didn't understand it. Most of the people I was around, I didn't see it in their family systems either, although their family systems always looked better than mine, except for one. basically kept that child shut down. And so I didn't develop a loving parent. Recovery is about developing, from my perspective, my recovery has been about developing, most of my recovery is about developing a strong and loving parent and developing self-love, self-care, self-integrity, self-dignity. When I have that in place, I don't need Mary to love me. The moment I need her to love me, as she says, I pull out a big, strong ticket right there in her chest and start sucking out the life force, you know, what she likes to call spiritual vampirism. So I'm getting my well-being from her rather than from me. And at times she may be getting it from me rather than from her and her higher power. And so in loving development, it's all that parent for me is always there. It's always present. It treats me with love, with respect, with integrity, with dignity. And it treats me with tough love, especially when my teenager wants to go do some things that may not be in my best interest. It'll step in and go, stop. It's not an option. No, it's not an option. We found many, many years ago in this industry that even the basic psychological principles found in the 12 steps are not spiritual principles, but the psychological principles are found in most parenting books written. The steps are all about forcing us to evolve into a parent that is going to treat ourselves and others with boundaries, with respect, with integrity, with dignity. I haven't found the event that brings that about yet, but what I have found is one event, one experience after another that has forced me to grow and evolve and change. So a loving adult in ideal development is basically our intellect, our thoughts, our thinking. And we basically are, as human beings, come to learn, we are thinking, feeling, behaving people. Well, the loving child carries the feelings. The loving parent carries the behaviors, the actions, and the loving adult is our thinking. And a loving adult is in many ways nothing more than a laptop computer in the back of my head. When I went to work, I would put on the adult altogether act, as it's been called for many years, that I put on the right clothes and the right words and the right actions and the right behaviors as a defense mechanism of protection rather than being in my parent and allowing myself to be truly authentic as my higher power intended me. Nobody gave me the freedom to do that growing up. So it became normal for me to hide in my adult and to put on the altogether act. And if I did it well enough, then you might not judge me. You might not shame me. You might not, whatever, laugh at me or dislike me, you know. And it's also what we've come to learn is that it's where the loving adult is where my ego lives, basically, because my ego is nothing more than what I think I am. And that can change 20 times in a day. One minute I can think I'm pretty good, I'm okay. Next minute, a fear message will kick in, or a shame message will kick in. Well, I screwed that up. And so then my ego shifts in the fear and shame. But loving adult is also loving ego. It's that I love and appreciate who I truly am. And I believe today, and my wish for all of us would be that we could live in it all the time, that we are truly amazing, loving, spiritual beings and perfect creations of a loving higher power. And I was taught to be everything but that. And so my recovery is about continuing to force that. So my child carries the feelings. My parent carries the actions and behaviors of self-love and self-care. And the love and care of others, including tough love and a balance of tough love and soft love. The loving adult carries my thinking. And my higher self, I believe, carries our soul and our heart connection to my higher power. Oh, and by the way, I neglected to say that loving child also carries the spirit of who we are. The most spirited beings in all the world are the children. And many philosophies that I've studied have taught me to, you know, that I need to continue to become far more like children and be as real as they are rather than try to make children like me as mechanical adults. And that's been part of my evolution, was just to be who I truly am and to do it with love and self-love and self-care. My higher self is a fourth, not actually, but I tend to refer to it as a fourth quadrant of my brain.
What's that, Kuti?
That is directly linked to my heart. And so I have identified my higher self in what I call the four ends. It's when I'm experiencing insight, intuition, and inspiration, and instinct. I'll repeat those. Insight, intuition, inspiration, and instinct. By the way, inspiration is a word that was squeezed together many centuries, or a few centuries ago, and it really means in spirit. So when I'm inspired, I'm also linked right back to my child that carries my spirit and my creativity. And it has nothing to do with the intellectual adult. My intellectual adult tends to want to go, you know, wants empirical data before it makes a decision. Everything has to be just lined up and perfect and orderly, et cetera. Then I can make the most appropriate decision. When my higher self goes right to my heart and my heart accesses wisdom far beyond what is available in this physical world form, and my heart will oftentimes immediately say yes or no, or look at this. And it knows because it's accessing wisdom far beyond that. But my intellectual mind doesn't like that, because my intellectual mind learned to operate from fear. And fear always starts with a thought first. So does toxic shame. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we move over to our manageable adaptations that we probably grew up with. So my higher self is for example, practicing my time with my higher power, it stretches. Is that part of my brain, the ability to turn off my intellect and my thinking and simply just be in prayer and meditation? So in meditation, I'm really forcing my adult, my intellect, to stop and simply be a human being, and which is where I connect with my higher power. My thinking generally takes me a step away from my higher power. So when I can stop, take a deep breath, move into my heart one more time and ask my heart what to do, or what's the circumstance, or what does this really mean? The answers are very different. And my intellectual mind doesn't understand that. It needs factual empirical data. And so a strong part of my recovery has been to learn to trust in my higher self and to trust in my heart, and use my intellect to gather information when necessary to support something or to conceptualize or to intellectualize. It plays an important role in my life, but not as a place, not as a base of operation. So ideal development would be to, you know, make the jump from a loving child into a loving parent, and that happens around 11 to about 14 years old. Loving parent into a loving adult. They discovered with more recently with the brain mapping, it was done through quantum physics, and is that we used to think that we kind of jumped into the adult at 18, 19 years old. Well, they have found now that in men, we don't even finish developing that part of our brain until 26 years old, and in women, it's 23. And I won't go into the reasons why it's different, but there's certainly lots of information out there you can research on about that. Yeah. So, you know, at 26 years old, my brain hasn't even finished developing into, you know, an adult and finished developing as a loving parent. So I wasn't even, you know, able to, I could act a certain way, but I wasn't able to maintain it because my brain hadn't developed enough yet to maintain being a loving parent. Instead, recovery has brought that forward for me, has brought all of these forward, actually, the loving child, loving parent, loving adult, loving higher self, and that we don't make the transition into a loving higher self. And most of what I've personally experienced and I've heard from others and as well as what I've read until about somewhere between 38, 45 years old. And in my loving higher self, it's not so much about what I've created and gotten from this world. You know, it's more about what am I going to give to this world? What am I going to offer to this world to access, you know, inspiration and insight and intuition and instinct from a higher power about what can I do to make a difference in this world as opposed to what can I get from this world? And so it isn't as though we stop living as a loving child because we're operating more from a loving higher self. Actually, in my experience, it's been that the more that I'm operating from my higher self, my loving child feels free, and with a loving parent for boundaries and perfection, my child feels free to just be authentic and real. And that's what my personal recovery and my relationship with myself has been about, is to create as safe a world as I can in my ability so that my child can come out and be natural and free. Unfortunately, what most of us probably developed in one degree or another, at least it's what I've heard from just about anyone I've talked with over 35 years, Dakota, is I developed an adaptive child. And that's a child who looks at the environment and determines, it's often called a passive, aggressive, adaptive child. And it's a child that looks at the environment that they're in and tries to determine what the authority figures in that family system want. And we become what we think they want because that's where our safety lies. If we can do what they want, maybe we won't be neglected or mistreated or abused or shamed or judged or harmed or hurt. We won't experience more trauma, more shame, more emotional or physical or sexual or intellectual or spiritual mistreatments of any kind. So we adapt to the environment, and I believe we adapt in two different ways. One is either in passive ways, and what they call the passive roles, and the look good roles, the right one, the good one, the perfect one, the caregiver, in codependence, it's a caretaker, there's thousands, literally thousands of roles that we adapt in very young ages, depending on our environment. The surrogate spouse to mom or dad, parent to the kids in the family, and can be, you know, dad's confidant, mom's confidant, the parent's best friend, the overachiever, super accomplisher. They're the look good roles, and then we based our identity on those roles. We tried to figure out how do we fit into this family system, and then who are we going to be, and we base our identity on it. And instead of developing a loving parent, we internalize an either overindulgent or critical parent, or both. And in my case, it was both. I came from a fairly affluent family, and so my mother and my father died when I was 15 months old. So I never knew him. But my mother basically equated love and money, and so she would indulge us, two older sisters, and she would indulge us with whatever we asked. But often, if I did ask for something, she'd criticize me, she'd shame me. You just want so much. You just want. What the hell is wrong with you? And then, you know, I knew how to play the game. Very often she would feel guilty. And then so she would come and give me exactly what I asked for. So I learned to play the game that way. But I had no one to help me contain my emotions. I had this child carrying all this trauma, this abuse, this shame, the family system dynamics, the rage, the anger. There was a rule in my family that no females could get angry because there were ugly words for angry women. And so they repressed it. So I had two older sisters and my mother, and men could get angry. They were hated for it, but they were tolerated. So I basically sucked up the anger of two sisters and my mother and mine. So when I got angry, I acted out times four, where she had the money to get me out of the picture. So I was sent away from 8 years old until the last half of high school. And I developed an internal judgmental critical parent based on all the messages that were given to me about the shaming message was given to me. Two different runs in military school. And after the second run, I got thrown out. And, you know, junior high school, I got thrown out. Grade school, I got thrown out. Two different high schools, two different. Finally, it was in extreme high schools that were, you know, for emotionally troubled kids. At a foundation in Santa Barbara and then in Texas, and just short of going to school. So I internalized a very critical, judgmental parent who would fire on that child with fear messages and shame messages. You can't wear that. Oh, what's wrong with you? When are you going to get it right? Boy, you. So I would just beat that child up with all sorts of critical messages, and they were based in fear and shame. And toxic shame are messages that I internalized. They were the lies about who I was that I couldn't sort out, that I internalized and thought and believed they were true. Toxic fear are the lies about how bad it's going to be. And it's always in the future. Fear is always in the future. It's never in the here and now. It could be the next moment, but it's not in the here and now. And so I will scare myself about, anything. And we'll what if? Well, what if this? Well, what if that? What if this happens? What if that happens? And scare this child. And what if that? And what if we screw up? What if it's wrong? What if we, and what if, you know, I scare myself here. And then if it turns out that, you know, something didn't go the way it was supposed to, somebody didn't like me or whatever, then I would just judge myself. What is wrong with you? God, are you ever going to get it right? Jeez. And I hear all these voices from the authority figures of my childhood, because the overindulgent critical parent internally within us is made up of all the voices and messages of all the authority figures from my childhood. And so I didn't develop a loving parent. I internalized all those as a critical indulgent parent who would fire on this child to keep it under control and then act in the altogether, act as an adult so that you guys wouldn't see me as afraid that you all would see me with fear and shame and judgment, because that was my experience for the first half of my life. So I would, rather than developing a loving thoughts and loving thinking as an adult, I developed fearful thinking and shame-based thinking. And I would feed the critical indulgent parent, who would then beat up on the child internally with all that toxic stuff. Where I noticed it the most, and we'll talk about it a little bit later, was a fourth step. As I started to do my first CODA fourth step inventory, I caught myself just beating myself up and, God, what's wrong with me? Write something else and go, God, you're really sick. And I write something else and, Jesus, you're just disgusting. I can't believe we did this. And I would just abuse that child rather than allow my heart to be present for my mistakes. I didn't recognize that what I was writing in my four-step inventory were my wounds, basically. Instead, I internalized them. I started writing them as aspects of my character and something wrong with me. So it took a while to work through that to where I could keep toxic shame out of my four-step inventory. We'll come back to that a little bit. What I developed with was a level of fear and shame thinking and a critical indulgent parent and an altogether act to look good so that nobody may judge me one more time. And an adaptive child who I had to keep repressed and shut down because he couldn't be authentic and real and exactly who my higher power wanted him to be and who I came into this world to be. And as a result, overall, rather than expanding my heart, my consciousness spiritually, connecting to my higher power, heart diminished. As all of this progressed, because it is progressive, then I would my heart would diminish. In other words, I would lose sight of and my a connection to most of any of the goodness in this world, because I thought I didn't deserve it. I thought I wasn't worthy of it. I became even more and more judgmental, and then I would go, picked up alcohol and drugs. And 9 years old, alcohol first, and smoking at 10, progressed to drugs at about 13 years old, was dying at 28. And they told me I wouldn't live to be 29 if I didn't stop using, and I didn't care. I just said it was good enough for my dad, it was good enough for me. So my heart had diminished by the time I was 28 to where I had no desire to even live. Like, as we know today, that alcohol and drugs and addictions are slow forms of suicide. And I was trying to kill the pain inside. I just didn't know that. And for another 7 years in recovery, in AA and NA recovery. I was still operating from fear and shame. And every relationship I had, I would sabotage because all that emotional energy would show up and affect the relationship and maybe backing away and walking away. And so I would not, I wasn't able to maintain loving relationships for any length of time. So basically, I pretty much destroyed three and a half marriages, half of the married, until we were able to get to get the help we needed and the therapy that we needed to do and clear out the history that kept beating up the relationship. But to do that, I needed to clear out the history of beating up my relationship with me first. And I needed to get right with my heart, my mind, my body, my soul, and my spirit. And in the process, make the journey from the left column slowly but surely over to the right column as to who's inside. Do I have a loving child? I developed, happened to be in therapy with a specific type of therapy. And I was talking about how I feel like this stupid kid all the time. You know, I can't let anybody see it. And he happened to say, well, bring him out. Let's talk to him. And this was long before inner child work was even a thing. And so I brought him up and I started to talk to him and started to develop a relationship with him. And so in a way, the therapist and I were both learning about this as part of the process. And I worked in the field for 7 years. I came to work in this industry when I got clean. And I've been working here ever since. So this wasn't necessarily new to me, but the experience of it was brand new. To actually talk to that little boy and tell him, I love you and I adore you and I delight in you. And the moment I would say that, huge amounts of pain came. Because I was now feeding him and his heart exactly what he needed to experience as a child. And it's up to me to re-raise that child within, because nobody else can. I mean, I can come to meetings, and I love coming to meetings. I come to meetings as part of my healing process, and I can share with others, but you can't raise that child for me. I have to, as they say, it's a program of action, and the action has all to do with the loving parent. And, we kind of made, as this has all evolved over the last 35 years, we made lots of inroads and insights and understandings, but there was a time when it was a big deal to have a couple thousand people in an audience and walk them into their childhood trauma and do so. It's called inner child work, but without a loving parent on board, there was no strength to handle what was coming up from that child. So I kept setting myself up again and again and again and again. So did others that have been doing some degree of codependence work, but there was no coda. And so I had no parent on board who was going to handle the emotional energy that would come up. It was devastating for a while. And Mary was the same way. So, you know, I had to work hard, and so did she, not to transfer parenthood to Mary so that she could make me okay and be there for this child. Because, you know, if she would just love me, then I must be okay. And it doesn't work that way. If she's having a bad day, she's not very loving today, then my higher power is gone. Just like I gave the higher power of God to a line of coke or a drink or drugs or whatever I could get my hands on, they made me okay. I would do the same thing with Mary. If she'd just be okay, then I'd be okay. And instead, I had to, as I was told by a therapist, who actually became one of our first board members for CODA. She had been working with Mary and I for, and working the steps on codependence, in therapy because there was no place to go. There was no program. You know, at one point, I'm just all my energy is focused on Mary, and she could see it. And she basically had to yell into my attention, you know, Ken, stop. And I was like, I just shocked. And she said, she is none of your business. None of your business. And at first I wanted to argue and defend. And it was like pretty quickly it went from up here to here. And I got it. She is none of my business. And I need to start showing up for myself. And what is it that I need to do? I had to get right in my life. I had to right myself. And I had to make sure that I'm loving me, and that way I don't need Mary. The moment I need Mary, she become my drug. Need always implies addiction. And I used to get very subtle in my negotiations with Mary. Well, I need you to do that. I need you to do that. No, I don't need you anymore. The fact is, I want her to, and if she doesn't, okay. The moment I attach my well-being to what Mary does, I'm in my codependence. I've abandoned this little boy. I've given it over to her, and she'll just do. Then I'll be okay. And so having to learn how to stop that and pull that energy back and focus on me and my higher power, which is the source of my well-being, my loving higher self, and it's a connection to that. And make sure that I develop that relationship, which again we'll talk about more about later on in the workshop, and make that journey slowly but surely from a diminishing heart to a loving higher self, a connection to a loving heart, from my fear and shame thoughts to loving adult thinking and intellect, and from a critical, judgmental, shaming, scaring parent to this child, to a loving parent who loves and adores this child, and the adapted child to a trusting child that believes that this parent will be there for me, which is, it took a long time for that to evolve because that child didn't trust me at all. But he does today. And it's not always perfect. Of course, I still make mistakes. I've got wounds. Those wounds can show up from time to time, especially if I'm hungry, angry, lonely, tired. If I'm a little too vulnerable or kind of shut things down, and not paying attention, you know, my history and my wounds can surface again. But the right column, the healthy who's inside, is what we strive for, I believe, in recovery. Strive to have a loving relationship with God and with myself. And when I'm okay with God and myself, I don't have any problems with him. It's amazing how that works. I don't have any problems with Mary. I don't have problems with my kids. I just enjoy being with them. I don't have them, but I get to enjoy being with them. My grandkids, friends, people I love, people I adore. And so it's an ongoing process of evolution. It's not like I can cut these other parts of me out of my brain, but basically just do a brief little mini lobotomy and get them out of there and just start developing this loving higher self, parent, child, adult. But it's an ongoing process. So reinforcing meetings help me to reinforce that I am a work in progress. I'm still learning to get stronger as a loving parent. I'm still learning to stop thinking so much and instead just be a human being and not a human thinking, which is like today I become a human computer, you know, and to be a loving being in my higher self. It's, to me, that's what my higher self is all about. I'm being far greater than what this physical world form is about. So it's evolutionary to me. It's always evolving. It's always changing. I think I'm just about out of time here. I'm going to pass this over to Mary, and she's going to start, take some time to talk about step two or three.
Here we go.
Hello, everyone. I love to talk about the steps. So just to read this, step two came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood God. Next slide. Thank you. So this is just kind of a way of looking at step two and three, just to talk a little bit about my own experience with step two and three. So I got sober in Clean and Sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and was in that program for just under 2 years before starting to work on my codependence. And I had done what I would say was an intellectual second and third step. So I had always had a belief in God. And so that wasn't necessarily a struggle for me to have that. But I didn't know what that meant. So I had an intellectual belief, but I didn't have anything that came from my heart. And I realized that when I had tried to work the second and third step in AA, I was never able to trust my higher power that, that truly, God would have my back, so to speak. And so I started, with some help, started looking at all of that. One, you know, codependence is referred to as a conflict in God. So I had many little sort of false gods, so to speak. You know, fear was a god of mine. Toxic shame was a god of mine. At times, Ken was my god or my children. You know, I gave my that, you know, what I looked to for my value, my worth and whether I was going to be safe over to emotions or people or sometimes my job was my higher power, you know, and so I had to get back to it. So what was it that I was seeing in a higher power? And so somebody had me do this exercise, sit down and, you know, write down some characteristics of your major caregivers. So I had actually three major caregivers. I had my mother, my father, and then I was also raised by a lot of coaches. So I had coaches in there. And they said, put down just one line, you know, the characteristics, personality characteristics of that person. So my mom, you know, she was rageful. She was violent. She was distant and avoidant of me. Didn't really have a lot to do with me. She was pretty self-centered into her life and what was going on with her. My dad sexually abused me, so we had that piece. He was also one of my coaches. He was also angry and distant and avoidant, and neither, you know, my mom had the emotion of rage. My dad didn't show any emotions. So I had these unavailable, uncaring, distant, abusive parents. That was my idea of authority figure. And then I had my coaches who, unfortunately, you know, I'm 67. And so when I was, doing a lot of sports during grade school and high school, I had you know, the old style of coaching where they shame you into doing better. So I had a lot of, emotionally abusive, coaches, also physically abusive in the way that they would make us, work out back then. Which wasn't necessarily safe for our bodies. So I had all these messages about authority figures. Well, you know, who was the biggest authority figure? You know, was, you know, a higher power. And I didn't realize how much transference I had been doing. So when I thought about, you know, praying or turning my will, my life over to the care of God, you know, what I had up come up was, okay, well, you know, God doesn't really care about me. God doesn't really hear me. God's there for all of you, but not there for me. You know, God's abusive and is going to harm me somehow, and I'm going to be punished for all these terrible things I did, and, you know, on and on and on and on. And, so if you could go to the next slide. So I had to ask myself, is, that the voice that I was going to turn my will, my life over to, you know, and it was not. It was not. I started drinking and using right around 9-10 years old. I get mixed up on about when it started taking place. But I had been medicating all that. You know, alcohol and drugs are my God for a long time. Eating disorders are my God, you know, any of the compulsions and addictions that I got into, which I think I could belong to about every 12-step program out there, any of those, you know, had become my higher power because I was looking for anything to medicate all those feelings I had about all those various authority figures and the traumas that went along with them. I had no clue at all that this is who subconsciously I was seeing as my higher power. You know, it didn't even occur to me that that had happened until I started working with it. And so then I had to, you know, really look at, okay, is this really who I want to turn my will and my life over to? Is this somebody that I can, am going to have in charge of my life? And the answer was no, of course not. Of course not. You know, I had spent, you know, a good portion of my life, running away from the emotions and the messages and the memories and all of that connected with all those traumas, that came out of my life. You know, I remember when I was working on, you know, cause, you know, I would say two things were the most profound out of my trauma. One was the sexual abuse. Because with sexual abuse, you know, what I came to learn is that it affects me not only sexually, but it also affects me physically and how I saw my body, whether I had any rights to my body or not. It affected me emotionally, because I was carrying the toxic shame from my dad and others who had sexually abused me. Intellectually, it messed with my reality. It's like nobody was intervening, so it must have been okay for this to go on. So I had a really tough time with owning my own reality. And spiritually, because every time an authority, my dad or others that had sexually abused me, anytime they asserted that will over me, they were being my authority at that moment. And so that one profoundly affected how I was going to be able to have a relationship with the higher power. Plus, I looked at God and went, why didn't you save me? You know, I'm sure, you know, many of you have some trauma had to ask that. It's like, why didn't you intervene? Why didn't you do something? Why? All this kind of stuff. And the reality was, is that my dad and others, my mother, all the, you know, individuals that I had experienced trauma from, they were all in their own self-will. I believe today what my higher power did was kept that sanity, that little girl, and, you know, that was experiencing all these different things. I think it kept my soul safe, so to speak, my sanity safe, so to speak. There was a part of me that was protected, even though I wasn't able to be protected over what was happening to me. And that has brought me peace. with that. Other people may have a different way of looking at it, but for me, that's what helped me to have some peace in there. You know, the other profound trauma was the abandonment neglect that I experienced and how that affected my relationship with my higher power and my concept of a higher power, because I truly did. I was agnostic, so to speak, where, again, I believe that, you know, God was there for all of you, but I had done too much. And so there was no way that God was going to be there for me. And you know, that was the same message I had as a little girl. You know, I was the youngest out of my two older sisters, and they were born prior to the Korean War or Korean conflict, and I was born after the Korean conflict. So there was a little bit of time in between us. They were much closer in age, I think 15 months apart. And then there was, after my middle sister, there was another at least a little over 4 years before I was born. And so I, you know, growing up, they were doing things that I was too young to do. And so even in that, just in the way that our ages all took place, I felt kind of apart and alone and isolated in a sense. And besides the fact that my parents were very abandoning and neglectful. Neglect, I came to learn, was about not only providing, but also teaching.
Rest.
So I was not taught emotionally. I was not my feelings, deal with my feelings. I was not taught, you know, physically how to take care of my body. I was not taught, you know, of course, sexual boundaries and healthy sexuality. I was also not taught, you know, how to own my own reality and intellectually, you know, so in all these different areas, I was not taught different things. And then abandonment had to do with presence. My parents were very busy all the time. And so they were not available. They were not available emotionally. Sometimes they were there physically, but they were not there emotionally. You know, they were too tied up in their own lives. And so, you know, all those different things created all those messages that I associated with authority figures that I then transferred over to my higher power. So I had to start an exercise, which I have you go to the next slide. Thank you. One more. We'll get to that side. There we go. There we go. Okay. So I started. There we go. Okay. So this is a step 2 and 3 exercise. So I'm going to go through this, and then I'm going to have you take just about 10 minutes. And just write. Now, you're going to probably take some more time after this workshop and write a lot more on it. So don't feel like you have to, you know, have everything done perfectly on this. But this will be something that you'll want to share with your sponsor and recovery friends, but especially with your sponsor, in that when we're doing question and answers, if you're also wanting to share a little bit about that, that's would be available as well. But I'm going to have you take about 10 minutes. These are the 4 questions. So the first one is, whose voice does your higher power have? So whose voice may be from your history? Maybe, you know, that you gave, you know, were authority figures in your life. And you can do that exercise, like I said, like was given to me, where you write down, you know, personality characteristics of mom, personality characteristics of dad. If there were step parents, put them down. If there were grandparents that helped raise you, put them down. And then write down the characteristics that you have of your higher power. I didn't share this part earlier, but write down the characteristics that you have of your higher power when you're in kind of a down place. Now, when we're in a good place, it's like, oh, God's love and light and peace and all this kind of stuff. But when we're in the depths of maybe our codependence, we're struggling, we've got some pain going on, maybe some shame going on, you know, who is my higher power then? And so maybe some one lines. And then you want to look for the similarities. You want to take that list that you have of your higher power and look for those similarities in the messages that you have written down and characteristics that you've written down about your authority figures in your life. And then you go to question number two. Is that voice one that you want to turn your will and your life over to? Yes or no, and why? And then number three, which is very important, is describe a loving higher power that you can turn your will and life over to, that you are open, willing, you know, ready to turn your will and your life over to. Create those characteristics, write those down. You can break them out in the five areas of, you know, who is your higher power emotionally? Who is your higher power physically? Sexually, intellectually, as well as spiritually, you know, who is your loving higher power and one that you can really embrace, one that you can begin even to look at turning your will and your life over to. And that one for sure, you may make some notes in this next 10 minutes, but for sure you're going to want to take some time and really look at that. And then number four, big question. Am I willing to put into actions the tools of self-loving and leave all the outcomes up to my higher power? So I'll say that again. Am I willing to put into actions the tools of self-loving and leave all outcomes up to my higher power? So I will not have any expectations of outcomes. You know, once we have expectations, we've already painted a picture and now we're playing God. Because it's got to turn out exactly the way we're supposed to. It's, you know, whatever my expectations are going to demand an outcome. And if you don't play up to my expectations, then I'll react, punish, go away, you know, any number of things. I personally believe that any time that we have expectations interpersonally, I believe when we have expectations interpersonally, we are boundaryless. We have no boundaries going on, which means that I'm going to be reactionary to life and the people in it. So that question again, am I willing to put into action the tools of self-loving and leave all outcomes up to my higher power? If yes, why? If no, why? So let's, I have 9:12 on my clock. Let's take until about 9:20, maybe 9:21 to do just. So we'll bring that exercise to a close. Again, I want to encourage you to take some time, you know, after the workshop to do a little bit more writing on this. And then be sure and share it with your sponsor, recovery friends, recovery group, to make sure that you are being able to talk about this and share your answers with somebody. It's a powerful exercise because the more we have that relationship with our higher power in place, it makes everything so much easier. And everything makes so much more sense. And it's much more graceful, so to speak, to move out of playing God or making others our God or making our feelings our God or any other, you know, jobs, kids, all of that, you know, to be able to truly have a relationship with the higher power as you see God. You know, it doesn't have to match anybody else. It's just as you see your higher power, however that works for you. So I'm going to bring Ken in. He's going to be talking about steps 4 through 7. And so I would ask to please move to the next slide. Thank you. Thank you.
I'm still Ken, and I'm still a grateful recovering codependent. I want to talk a little bit about steps 4, 5, 6, and 7. Again, these four steps alone, we could spend, you know, a whole day's workshop on. But so we're going to keep it brief. But I wanted to read them first, and then I want to talk about these steps. And then we'll go, after that, we'll go to the next page and talk about the exercises. But, so step 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step 5, admitted to God, ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these character defects of character. And step 7, humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. So 4 and 5 tend to go, actually all 4 of these go together. But I want to focus just on 4 and 5 for a few minutes and talk a little bit about doing especially a 4th step. My experience has been when I've done 4 steps intellectually and without allowing myself to experience my feelings about the truth of what I was writing about, it didn't impact me. It was more of an intellectual assignment, and I could check that off and say it was done, but the most powerful 4 steps I've ever done were when I did them from my heart and from a feelings level and allowed myself to experience my feelings about what I had said and done or didn't say and didn't do, especially in my relationship with me. That was the hardest, because it was so vague in some ways in the beginning. And so focusing on my relationship with me and my behaviors towards me, did I, you know, give much time to this child part of who I am? Did I judge him? Did I shame him? Did I scare him? Did I avoid him? Did I rage at him inside? You know, did I put him in harmful situations? I had to look at, was I lying to myself? And certainly there were many situations where I did lie to myself and convinced myself that what I was doing was okay somehow, but it wasn't, you know? It was helpful for me to ask myself, to take it outside of myself and say, would I do this to my children or my grandchildren? Would I treat my children or grandchildren this way? No. But I wouldn't hesitate to treat myself that way. I would judge me, shame me, scare me. You know, an example was I caught myself this morning and I went in to look for a shirt to put on. And I picked this one up and I heard this voice say, "You're not going to wear that, are you?" And it was like, oh my God. It was like, well, what was perfect timing for this workshop? But one more time, that critical, shaming, scaring parent was judging me, and this parent stepped right back in and said, "Back off, stop it, don't ever talk to me that way." So I had to stand up for that child, and then that little boy could look at me and go, "You are there for me. That's amazing. And the more that I do, the more he says that to me. And I can tell you that there was a time when that little boy basically was progressively telling me things like, you know, I'm starting to trust you. I'm starting to believe you. I'm starting to believe you. I really do matter, don't I? I am important. And so he's, you know, at one point he basically wanted to make sure he told me, I said, I really do trust you. I really do believe in you. And one time he just, that part of me got my attention and he said, you were so awesome. And I was, it brought me to tears. And I realized right after he said that, after the tears cleared, that I was experiencing self-trust, self-belief, self-esteem, self-care, self-love, you know, feeling awesome to myself, not in an egotistical way. And the only source it ever came from was from that child to me. And I gave all of that away to everybody. If I could just do it well enough, if I could just get him to say something good about me, if Mary with my kids and my grandkids, people, situations. I remember I was in a situation with, I was speaking at a big conference and there were about 300, I don't know, people. And there was a guy in the pretty much the middle of the audience, and he was like fussing. That's not for me. Anyway, and he was fussing and moving around and rolling his eyes and picking up his phone, I went into a fear and shame, and oh, this guy's upset. He doesn't like me. He's judging me. People message, I'm not enough. I'm not doing this well enough. I'm not saying it well enough. And I had this mini shame attack. And so I was able to contain that and tell myself, well, I'm going to go, hunt him down. As soon as I'm finished here, I'm going to go look for him and find out what's really going on. So I actually found him, and, I couldn't tell him. I couldn't be vulnerable enough yet and honest enough to go, I saw that you were stressing and uncomfortable and kind of rolling your eyes, and it scared me and I was afraid you were judging me. Instead, I went, hi, how you doing? Are you okay? And so sure enough, he came back and he said, oh, you know, what you're sharing was great. My ex-wife, she was just tormenting me and sending me these texts. It was just driving me crazy. So it had nothing to do with me. And it was one more time when I went, oh my goodness, how toxic shame and toxic fear are the most self-centered things in the entire planet. When I'm in toxic shame, of course it's always about me. Guy rolls his eyes, must be about me, you know. But so those were things that I needed to include on my four-step interview. I needed to take a very specific look at and start reframing that with the loving self parent. The moment toxic shame message starts to come in, that parent needs to show up and protect that child. Back off, be quiet, and don't talk to me that way. And then I'll hear that voice go, yeah, but no, it's not an option. Don't talk to me. Well, I've got no. So the internal dialogue, it's either going to be loving or it's going to not be loving. And today I choose loving. But if enough is happening over a short period of time where I recognize that I'm doing that, I'm kind of toxic and scaring myself, and some things are happening, I will often do a mini four step very quickly, once again, on my relationship with me. What's my part and why? What's going on there? Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. To me, that's magic. And the magic to me isn't in that I admitted to God, because because my higher power already knows. It's not like I was hiding anything from my higher power. It's not like I somehow act out from some of my wounds and my higher power go, whoa, I can't look. I can't watch that. You know, my higher power already knew. The magic for me and the sense of equality and humanness and spirit was in sharing with another human being the exact nature of my wrongs and doing it with honesty and vulnerability. And when I do it from my heart, it's going to bring up two feelings for me, usually guilt and shame, healthy shame. Guilt being the feeling I'm going to feel that will push me to strengthen my values so I don't do that again. And shame is the healthy shame. It's the shame of my actions and my behavior, which provides me a sense of humility. And it humbles me. It lets me know that I'm human, I'm fallible, I make mistakes. I'm not wrong, I'm not bad, I'm wounded, and I make mistakes, and I'm going to learn from them, no matter what, which is what 6 and 7 are all about. I wanted to talk about 6 and 7 as a simple tool that I've learned, developed over many years, that I use with people that are working a 6 and 7 step with me. I found it interesting in step 7, humbly ask God to remove my shortcomings. The only way that I can humbly ask God is I need to be humbled through my emotional experience. I wrote about in my fear and my fearless and moral inventory. If I'm honest on an emotional level, brings me to a sense of humility, and I can humbly ask God for shortcomings. I believe that 6 and 7 are very similar in nature. I think that the first 6 steps were actually written by a fundamentalist Christian group called the Oxford Movement about 90 years ago, say, at this point. And so the vernacular, defects of character, just those alone, can be shaming that I have these defects. No, I don't have defects. I actually have learned behaviors and wounds that I experienced, and I can learn to change those learned behaviors and learn new ones, and I can allow myself to heal the wounds, because healing only comes emotionally. Until I feel it, I can't heal it, as they say. It's in the emotional processing that I let go. For me, even I'm working on a first step on my history with my family, I can't change what happened to me. The only thing I can change is how I feel about it. And that's how, in time, most of my story has become just that, a story, and without a lot of emotional power behind it, because I've done 35 years progressively of healing, and I still have the rest of my life to go. I love this process. And so the 6th step, the defects of character, were I believe that step 7, Bill Wilson wrote the rest of the 12 steps at his kitchen table one night. And I think it was his way of writing the same thing as what was written 6, but in a more loving way. There are shortcomings. Yeah, I have shortcomings. But I don't have defects. I'm not defective. It's a very shaming process. So I believe the two really, for the most part, say the same thing, although people will argue with me about that, which is fine. It's what I do believe. And I found that a friend of mine actually sent me an outline that he uses with his clients in NA in Las Vegas, and he basically said, that he has his sponsees, when they're doing 6 and 7, take 3x5 cards or smaller, and they write on one side, they write the shortcoming from the four-step inventory, whichever that might be, right? The shortcoming, and then they somehow this got changed to the exercise. Can you go back to the previous slide? Anyway. Oh. There we go. Thank you. I appreciate that. So they write the shortcoming on the 3x5 card, and then, which was my error or my ineffective or unhealthy or mistreating behavior, or lack of healthy behavior. And then on the other side of the card, we write the most loving behavior in response to it. And then there might be 20 of those, you know, based on that inventory that I just did, various behaviors, et cetera. So rather than trying to work on all of those and feel overwhelmed by that list, you take that first card, basically, and fold it up to small little pieces and put it in an envelope, or put it in a jar, and then take each one of those and fold them all up and put them in the jar. And what he has his sponsees do is pick one every day and just open it up, read it, and focus on that one per day. And it's amazing that when I've done that with people that I sponsor, when I've done that with clients, when I've done that with myself, that whatever I draw somehow draws it to me all day long. I get a chance to practice the new behavior because nothing's going to change in me, even with doing a fourth or fifth step, until I change the behavior. And it's so important for me to take the action to change the behavior. If not, I'm doomed to repeat the same thing again and then do a fourth step, repeat it, do a fourth step. I can own it, but nothing changes until I experience my feelings and then change my behavior. That's what I believe. 6 and 7 is all about. It's changing my behavior. The old timers used to say, well, 4, 5, 6, and 7 separate from the men from the boys and women from the girls. And I believe that to be true, very much so. So if we could have the next slide, please. So I wanted to talk a little bit about these exercises. And then we'll, like as before with Mary, I'll have you take a little bit of time to start in response to each of these exercises. As Mary had said, it's really important to continue to follow through. Our hope here was to just help you get started and then continue the work on your own, but also with a sponsor and your recovery friends, support group. Hopefully your home group, et cetera. Step 4, we recommend list out, examples of how you harm yourself by not loving yourself, your inner child, your inner teen, your inner spiritual self, your inner parent, your inner adult, physically, emotionally, sexually, intellectually, and spiritually. It's how you may have mistreated you. And the obvious ones are in the types of abuse that we talk about, abuse, abandonment, enmeshment, and neglect. The obvious ones are the abuse and the enmeshment. Enmeshment being highly entangled with another person. But the abandonment and the neglect are the hardest ones to see. It took a while to recognize that, I was emotionally neglected growing up. Nobody showed up to teach me about my feelings, that they were all good, that I had a right to them, and that they would be present and available to listen to my feelings, even if I was angry at them. They never taught me skills and how to approach those feelings and deal with them and get resolution. Instead, I was taught how to stuff, suppress, run, avoid, control, manage, manipulate my feelings. And so I did that as an adult to my child and my teen. That's because that's where those feelings come from. So I emotionally neglected my child and teen a lot. So that's just one example, or, you know, there are many. Neglect being what I didn't get that I needed to get. Abandonment means, you know, the obvious ones are somebody left my life as a child. The more difficult one, but the more powerful one, is when a present, a parent, an authority, whatever that may be, was present but not available. So I'm starving, and the source of food is right in front of me, but they won't give it to me. So I'm going to continue to starve. That's the most powerful abandonment of all. And so have I done that to myself? Have I done that to my child? And as I've done this list and really put heart and care, it's a four-step, something I encourage people to do a little bit at a time. And keep consistent with it so that you get through it and finish it. But still, do a little bit at a time, because it can be pretty emotionally overwhelming. So encourage people, take your time. But list out the examples and trust when it's time to stop. Maybe some people focus only on the physical, and then the next time they sit down with it, the emotional, then the sexual, spiritual, and emotional. And then once again, sharing with your sponsor and your recovery friends, that's where the magic of step five comes in. It allows me to recognize I'm just a human being, not bad, I'm not wrong. I simply learn things that are harmful and hurtful to me and to others. And I'm in error, or I make mistakes. I just encourage people to avoid judgmental words, because otherwise I got to take that and put it back in my list of examples, you know. And then step six, write out what you would like your life to look like if you loved yourself, and let your imagination soar. And this may take some time, but we're going to open up a little bit of time for you all to start achieving these. I want to encourage you to really put your heart into what that might look like. You know, what does loving yourself look like emotionally, physically, sexually, intellectually, spiritually? What does it look like in terms of tough love, you know, boundaries, internal boundaries, basically? External boundaries are more about the parent, but internal boundaries are from the parent as well, but they're forms of tough love. I might have a teenager, part of me, who wants to go, and that parent has to back up, so they say, no, that's not an option right now. Maybe we could later, but not now. And letting your imagination soar. Imagination, something I neglected to mention when we were talking about the child, parent, adult, higher self. Imagination comes from the higher self. Fantasy, which is so much of what drives codependence, addiction, basically. That comes from the child and the teen. And I can get high in a kite on fantasy because it forces the brain to release dopamine, serotonin, epinephrine, and then my body to release adrenaline. So I'm pretty much doing a cocaine high when I'm into fantasy. But imagination is the workshop of the spirit. And so when I'm imagining and letting my heart run the possibilities of what could be and imagining what they are, it opens the door to my higher power, to the spirit, and I get flooded with concepts. I get flooded with ideas. Whole concepts are downloaded in an instant of thought. It's amazing that when we start to stretch our imagination and let it grow, I believe, in my experience, that when I do, the moment I do, I open a portal, and the spirit is with me. And those that are with me, my higher power, see it step right in. So experiment. Let your imagination soar. And sometimes it's helpful to take it outside of yourself and to look at people you consider to be loving parents. What is it they do? How is it that they act? Do they treat their children as equals? Treat them with integrity? do they treat them as though they're, they matter and as you're just as important as the children matter and just as important as they are and anyone else? Do they give them respect of equality? Do they have the right to come and confront them as a, do the children have the right to come and confront the parent as a parent? Now, this is all internal boundaries and internal love. And then the last exercise, you know, right with heart, thought, consideration, prayer to your higher power. And that may take some time. You want to search your heart and let your heart write it, not your head. You know, basically, stop thinking and see what your heart says. What would your heart pray to your higher power? And write that prayer and then use it every day. And allow your higher power to be a guiding force. And then, of course, the last example I would bring up would be steps 6 and 7. It is to do the 3x5 cards when you finish the 4-step inventory. So that gives you focus once a day on one item that you can practice changing your behavior with. And I've been blown away if I would draw a card, how many people would be drawn to me, or situations and circumstances would be drawn to me with that particular card. It's just amazing. So what I'm going to suggest now is we've got probably about 10 minutes to take the last 10 minutes here. Up until about 10 o'clock. Let's go to 5 after 10. And write on these exercises, at least to start them, so that once, I think it's helpful to, there's a lot of information to write about here, but it's helpful to at least start on them so that you give yourself, with fresh information, an opportunity to put your thoughts down on paper. So. Let's take up until about 5 after 10 and then stop for a break. So I will, if you have a question and you need something, let me know. I will be here, we're close. So we're going to take a 20-minute break here pretty quickly, but before we do, I just wanted to remind you all to please, and when you can, take some time after the workshop to continue the journaling and the writing about each of the questions and follow through on sharing those with your sponsor and with your support group, your recovery friends. It's how we keep moving through it and let it go. I believe I think this would be a good time. Okay, we're going to take a break now for about 20 minutes. We'll meet back together at about 10:25. So let's go ahead and do that. And
say, Ken.
Yes.
Could you please summarize the items that go on the index cards before you go?
Oh, I'd be glad to.
Thank you.
Everything that was listed in the 4-step inventory. So you would take one item at a time that you listed. I neglected when, for example, I'm trying to think of one. I just heard from someone recently saying that they, every time pain comes up, they shove it down, convert it to anger, and then it comes out the side of the neck. So basically, they're suppressing the child's true pain, which is the source of its healing, they learn to stuff that pain. So you can write that, I stuff my pain and abandon my child's pain and healing. And then on the other side of the card would be a much higher, loving, healthy way to approach that, which might be, I embrace my tears and my pain as they cleanse my heart, my soul, and my spirit. So that would be one example. I could give you many if you like, but does that make sense? Is that what you were asking?
Yeah, it was in the chat, so hopefully that answered it. Thank you.
Oh, so those behaviors would be what was listed out on a four-step inventory. Or lack of behaviors, especially if those are neglect and or abandonment. You know, I neglected to show up for my child's feelings. I don't talk to my child. You know, I ignore that part of me. That would be a form of neglect. So on the other side would be of the card would be I am having daily conversations with my child. Loving conversations with my child. You know, I encourage people as they grow a connection, conscious connection with their child within to start to talk to them every day. In other words, tuck them in before you go to sleep. Make sure they're tucked in safely and are comfortable and at peace. And I found that people come back and tell me, you know, I do that every night. When I do, I sleep so much better. And so though that might be another example. You know, wake up in the morning, make sure you tell them that you love and adore them and that you're going to create the most amazing day for them. Even though we have to work today, we're going to make it amazing. So, because that's all I've got. You know, if I give that away to Mary and try to get Mary to do that for me, she's not having a good day today, I'm in serious trouble. So. Anyway, I could give you many examples, and we can later on if you'd like. So if there's nothing else, we'll take a short break, and then we'll come back together at 10:25. All right. Thank you all.
Thank you, Ken. This is Jack, your co-host and MC. Sarah has a few things that she wants to talk about, some announcements for CODA.
Okay.
Sarah?
Hi, everybody. I'm Sarah. I'm a codependent. And there are some other events that I'm going to screen share and also put in the chat, I think. Now they're in the chat, and there is the CODA International Convention. Oh, that's October 9th, 8 to 2 Arizona time, so that would be 11 to 5 Eastern. And there's also September 24th through the 26th, a Spanish convention. And the link is there. And as was mentioned, I believe, October 22nd through the 24th is the 35th anniversary convention. And I have on there also the Saturday 1 to 3 Arizona time speaker workshop every Saturday. So those are the links, either CODA.org or azcoda.org, and the Spanish link. You can find the Spanish workshop convention also on CODA.org. So thank you very much.
Okay, everybody, we're about ready to start. Whenever they're ready, Ken and Mary, but I just want to make a note here that please mute your phone, mute your computer so that Ken and Mary won't have any background artifact, and unmute when you need to speak or want to share. Thank you. They should be with us in just a minute here. It looks like we're going to start on the forgiveness steps, step 8 and 9.
And I'm here, Jack, ready to go.
Okay. Sounds good. Mary, whenever you're ready, go ahead and start. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the forgiveness steps. To begin with, step 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. So in this case, because we're talking about developing a loving relationship with ourselves, that's who's going to be on that list. So it's just ourselves. Step 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except
when to do so would injure them or others. And again, yourself goes on that for this exercise. So if you could go to the next slide there. So just, you know, before I'm going to be sharing the guided imagery with you all, but just to talk a little bit too about forgiveness as we're going through these two steps. You know, I remember, you know, early on in my life in early recovery, also I would think of forgiveness. And if I was, you know, say in the case with my father around the sexual abuse, if I was going to forgive him, that meant that I was saying it was okay and not to worry and no big deal and all of this. I had read, and this was many, many years ago, in recovery, and it helped me with this. So, but it was the Aramaic word for forgiveness was shah, and that it meant to untie. And so I had started looking at, okay, forgiveness was I am going to untie emotionally from this person, let them go. Let them do whatever they're going to do, deal with their own selves, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent. I didn't have to agree with it, not agree with it, like it, not like it, whatever it was that happened. I just needed to emotionally untie, and to let them go. And so then I started practicing. Okay. I can emotionally untie. It's sort of like with acceptance. I don't know about any of you with acceptance, you know, in the beginning, I could accept something. So I could accept something. I didn't have to like it, but I could accept it that it was, you know, if I had a, you know, black dress, I may not like that black dress, but I could accept I had a black dress. So, and then I started learning that there was another way to look at this, and was loving acceptance. So as opposed to having, I don't like it, having some judgments, all that kind of stuff, but I'm going to accept it, you know, kind of thing, that I could move into another stage of that, of lovingly accepting whatever it is, even if I still didn't agree with it or it wasn't my preference, I could lovingly accept something. So I took that and I started looking at forgiveness. So I could emotionally untie from, you know, and forgive somebody, or emotionally untie and forgive myself as well. But then I wanted to take that into a place of being able to lovingly forgive. You know, what I know about codependence is that it is intergenerational. It goes from one generation to the next, to the next, to the next. And each generation will either do something similar or they'll go to the opposite extreme, but still dysfunction is dysfunction, whether it's 180 degrees from one end to 180 degrees to the other end. And so there's really nobody to blame. That was huge for me. And especially at looking at these steps, there was really nobody to blame. That included in connection with what we're working on today, that meant me too. I did not need to blame myself. I could lovingly accept myself for who I am. I could lovingly forgive myself for my past mistakes and be able to move on. You know, Ken was talking a little bit about shame, and, you know, healthy shame allows us to know that we're human beings and we make mistakes. The toxic shame is more about humiliation and I'm bad, I'm wrong, I am the mistake. But healthy shame allows us to recognize that place of humanness. And so from there, I can learn to lovingly forgive myself for my past mistakes. I don't have to go into shaming myself, beating myself up. All of that is more about the disease of codependence than it is about recovery with codependence. So recovery from codependence means I can hold myself accountable in a loving way. I can forgive myself in a loving way. I can make my amends in a loving way, whether they're to myself or someone else. But I can approach things differently and without that toxic shame. That was huge for me. That was huge for me. So I am going to walk you all through a guided imagery. So what I would ask is that you get comfortable. I'm going to be having you close your eyes for those of you who are willing to do this. It'll take, a few minutes to go through the imagery. But to let yourself get in a comfortable position, close your eyes and begin to breathe. Breathing slowly, way down deep into your belly. Breathing out nice and slowly. Taking another breath in slowly, way down deep into your belly. And breathing it out nice and slowly and letting your body relax with each breath that you're slowly taking in, slowly breathing out. And remember to continue your breathing throughout this exercise. So while you're breathing, I want you to ask your higher power to guide you through all that you are going to see and experience. Allow yourself to move into a safe space, one that you create. This may be a safe space that includes an ocean or a meadow or a quiet place within your heart or your spirit. Whatever feels safe to you, allow yourself just to breathe into that sense of safety. Now I want you to invite in and allow yourself to see your higher self, your heart, that wise part of you, that loving higher self. And notice what this part of you looks like. Notice the love and the wisdom in their eyes. And notice how it feels to see this part of you. And breathe. Now I want you to ask your higher self to bring in your adult self that has all the messages and data, all the shame data, the judgmental or critical data, but also has your recovery data and everything you've been learning in recovery, all the new ways of thinking. And notice what it feels like to see this part of you. And breathe. Then I want you to invite in and allow your parent self. Both that part of your parent self that is loving and caring and loves you unconditionally. And also the parent self from the past that may be critical or abusive or dismissive again, notice what it feels like to see this part of you. And breathe. Nice and deep. Now I want you to invite in your smaller inner child. They may be around 6, 7, 8 years old, maybe even a little younger. And notice the sweetness and the innocence in them, the beauty in this child. You may even see some of the woundedness in their eyes. And notice what it feels like to see this part of you. And breathe. And now the last part of you that you're going to invite in to this group is your inner teen. They may be an early teenager at 13 or 14, or they may be 16, 17, 18 years old. But invite in your teen. Be aware of this inner teen and who they are and what they feel like and what they look like. And look into their eyes and notice what you see. And notice how it feels to see this part of you. So I want you to invite all these parts of you to sit in a circle with you, much like we do in our meetings. And notice how it feels to see all these different parts of you that are so precious and special and so needed. And breathe. And now I want you to see your higher self and hear your higher self asking your higher power to bring in and fill all these parts of you full to overflowing with absolute divine one love. Breathe into it, feel it, notice it. Allow it to fill you. And notice as you do this, the attitude and messages of the adult self is transforming into loving, empowered wisdom. And see that glow of wisdom just surrounding your loving adult. And allow the love of forgiveness to be directed to your adult self and look at them and say, I forgive you. And breathe. Now I want you to see your higher self asking your higher power to do the same with your parent self and notice that loving self-parent transforming from the dysfunction of criticalness or overindulgence
to one of love and wisdom and strength and empowered loving boundaries. Feel it, embrace it. Allow the love of forgiveness to be directed to your loving self-parent and say, I forgive you. Begin to see the love and light of the circle growing brighter as you move into love and forgiveness. And next, I want you to see your inner team and allow that one love of your higher power to fill them. Let them know they're loved, that they are enough, that they are forgiven for any mistakes they might have made while trying to survive. Let them know their love beyond measure. And tell them, I forgive you. And breathe. And see that light and love around your circle getting even brighter. Now see the little one inside of you. See their woundedness, their innocence. And look into their eyes and see and feel as they are filled with your higher power's divine love. And see and allow the love from all the parts of you to flow into your little child. Feel this and see your sweet, precious little inner child shine bright with the love energy of all the parts of you. And breathe. And tell them, I forgive you. Take a moment and allow yourself to look into the love-filled, forgiving eyes of all the parts of you, the beautiful parts of you, your loving higher self, your loving adult, your loving self-parent, your loving teen, your loving little inner child. See the magnificence of the beautiful circle of love and light as you continue to sit in circle and begin to join hands with each other. And feel that love just passing from one part of you to the next, to the next, to the next. And breathe it in. Breathe it in till you can feel all parts of you flowing in the oneness of love. In the beauty and magnificence of that love. And breathe. See this love energy integrating the whole of you, all these parts of you. And allow all these parts of you to come together as one. Embracing the sacred love connection that you have
with your higher power. Know that you are never alone. And breathe. Now take a moment and give thanks to your higher power, to your loving higher self, to your loving adult, to your loving self-parent, to your loving teen, and to your loving little inner child. And allow the love and gratitude to flow continually through you. Continue feeling this love-filled wholeness as you open your eyes and come back to the room you're in, knowing that these are the complete parts of you, beautiful parts of you, and that you can access them at any time. You can be in that oneness at any time. And breathe. So one of the things I would suggest is, you know, if maybe after the workshop or make some notes about your experiences through the imagery. And again, share that with your sponsor, with your recovery friends in your meeting. You can revisit that imagery anytime and recreate it for yourself. It's yours. And so this is going to take us into step 10. So I'm going to ask if you could. Thank you. This is a step 10 exercise that works really well. So step 10 is continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. So in this exercise, you know, Ken and I have you know, shared those five areas, the physical, emotional, sexual, intellectual, and spiritual. So this is just another way of doing a step 10 when we're looking at that relationship with ourselves. So if you can do this on a daily basis, of course, it's very helpful, but I would do it frequently for yourself. But a couple things. So you want to ask yourself, how have I loved myself? How have I shown up for myself, cared for myself, respected myself, or in any other ways of loving self-care in those five areas, the physical, emotional, sexual, intellectual, and spiritual? And just let yourself write it out. You're going to notice if there's areas that it's like, wow, I'm doing really good in this area. Maybe areas you want to work a little bit more on some loving self-care. And you want to look at any areas that you need to be accountable to yourself for any mistakes you might have made in the treatment of yourself in those same five areas. So that could be in self-talk, you know, did you make a mistake and then begin to shame yourself or criticize yourself? So you want to be accountable and to yourself in those areas. Practice an attitude of love, forgiveness, and gratitude daily. It lifts our vibration. It just feels good. And it keeps things in balance. You know, recovery
is a mixture of, you know, lots of feelings around our woundedness and our traumas and our struggles, as well as our victories and serenities and all of that. And so practicing an attitude of love, forgiveness, and gratitude daily helps with all of that. So thank you. I'm going to now turn this over to Ken, and he's going to talk to you about the 11th step. And for about 15 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
Welcome.
Thank you. I enjoyed that. Excuse me. We're going to take a few minutes here to talk about the 11th step that we sought through prayer and meditation. I have so many people who say prayer and meditation, and I've said that myself many times, but it's actually prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand God, praying only for God's knowledge for us and the power to carry that out. It took a long time for me to truly trust in the higher power of my understanding, because the higher power of my understanding was originally it had tremendous human characteristics associated with it. As a matter of fact, I had an old AA sponsor who just said, hey, brainstorm all the one word characteristics of your higher power. So I poured all these out, but they were words like judgmental, unavailable, critical, deems me undeserving and unworthy. I'm not good enough. All the toxic shame messages that came out of the higher powers and authority figures, basically, from my childhood. So, sure, I'm going to seek, you know, for knowledge of that higher power's will for me. I wasn't going to. I did this step intellectually, but I didn't put my heart into it because I really didn't really trust until I could really pursue a loving relationship with a loving higher power, which means I had to take all those human characteristics out of my relationship with God, and had realized I had transferred all the characteristics of the authority figures from my childhood onto my higher power, which, you know, of course I wouldn't be able to do anything else. And so the opportunity and the freedom to create a relationship with a higher power through step two, one that I could trust, it took time to learn to really trust that. And so, as I had said earlier, that the higher self's part of what the higher self encompasses is imagination. And so, when I look at the step and I sought through prayer and meditation, excuse me, prayer to me is a conversation with my higher power. And I used to do, long time ago, I used to do rote prayers again and again and again. One day I heard this voice, which clearly I know today is my higher power, said, don't tell me what's on your mind, tell me what's on your heart. And had this epiphany that I had been doing rote prayers, intellectual rote prayers, most of my life, if at all, and that I wasn't praying from my heart, and I wasn't having a conversation with my higher power. So I had to practice for a little while having a conversation with my higher power and imagine what my higher power's answers were. And actually, because of that, I worked about an hour, more than an hour, out of town at a treatment center, about an hour's drive from here. for Phoenix in. And I had to have, you know, that hour, you know, on my mind. And I kept hearing this voice go, because I was struggling with, you know, sending people home from treatment who had been treated for codependence, but they had no place to go. And they'd go to meetings like, they'd go to other programs, 12-step programs, and they would be confronted. We don't want you to come back because we don't deal with that issue here, codependence. And so, you know, we deal with alcohol, we deal with drugs. And so they had no place to go. And we were at a place where we really needed to do some work or have a place to go for ourselves rather than paying a therapist to be a sponsor. So, this voice kept saying to me, Ken, start a meeting. And I heard, I can't do that. I heard myself go, no, that's for people like, you know, other people, Bill W., Dr. Mott, those people, the deserving people. I can't do that. And I kept hearing it. And my higher power wants something of me. My higher power is relentless. So probably about 2 months, at least 3 times a week, on the way home, Ken, I'm telling you, start a meeting. You know? And I had learned to go to my heart and interact with my higher power from my heart. And the more I did, the more pain came up about the messages that I was telling myself. I'm not enough. I'm not good enough. That's for other people, et cetera, et cetera. So finally, after, I don't know, it was one day, I just said, all right, I'll talk to Mary. And I heard my higher power said, good. So I talked to Mary. We started a conversation. We ended up being a little bit codependent about what others would think. We went to others and said, what if there was kind of a meeting that was sort of kind of, you know, helpful for codependents with steps, et cetera. And these were people that worked in the industry that we knew were working on codependence, but had no place to go as well and were members of other programs. So I learned to trust that my higher power speaks to me, first of all, through my heart, and that prayer is a conversation with my higher power, and that meditation is a way for me to stop thinking so I can just move to my heart and experience my conscious connection with my higher power. And what we encourage people to do, and I would encourage all of you to do, is to pray and meditate daily. You know, even if it was for a minute or 2 minutes or 5 minutes, nurture and evolve your relationship with your higher power. It is so, so important. Because that's the source of my power. I believe that's the source of all power. And if I don't access that, then I'm going to feel powerless. If I want to feel empowered, rather than powerful, because I just use powerful to compensate for feeling powerless. If I really want to feel empowered, then the source of that empowerment comes from the higher power. I need to go there to make that connection and nurture that relationship. I had heard, and I found myself working with somebody professionally, and they were struggling with this. And I just said, how much time do you spend in your relationship with your partner? This person was married. And he said, well, you know, evenings, you know, 2-3 hours every evening, and weekends, and sometimes we go our separate ways and we do stuff together, but figure, well, 20, 25 hours a week. And I said, and so do you nurture that relationship through that time you spend? And he said, yes, absolutely. And I said, so how much time do you spend in your relationship with higher power? And he went, about 5 minutes a day, maybe a quick rote prayer when I get up, a quick rote prayer when I go to sleep. You know, that's about it. It's like, well, we're going to get out of a relationship whatever we put into it. If we want a rich, deep, spiritually experiencing a relationship with a higher power, then we've got to put our heart into it and we've got to put time into that part. If we don't, then we'll only get out what we put into it. So what I wanted to do was to, if we could change the slide, to the next exercise. We're going to take about, maybe 10 minutes and let you just put some time and thought into these questions and journal a little bit on them. We'll close this part. Mary will come in and share a little bit about the 12-step, and then we're going to move on to have time for as many questions as people may have. So, generally, got muted somehow.
I hear you now.
I was muted, and we need to go back a page. There we go. Thank you. Do you know and trust that God's will for you is for you to love yourself unconditionally and with abandon? No, question one. And question two, does loving yourself enhance your relationship with your higher power? And what I would add to that is, if so, how? We're going to take about maybe, 10 minutes, 8 to 10 minutes, for you to focus on that journaling now. And then, Mary will be back to talk a little bit about step 12, and then we'll move on from there. So, all right. Well, thank you.
Okay. We're going to continue on to step 12. If you could go to the next slide, please. Thank you. So, step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry the message to other codependents and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So, I love this step. It is a way to begin to give back what we've been given, but it all starts with that spiritual awakening, doesn't it? You know, so here we are. We're get to step 12, and we are more awake spiritually. And I say more awake because I don't know that we ever 100% arrive at anything, whether that's our recovery or our spirituality or consciousness with our higher power. And so I have done these steps so many times. I'm in the middle of doing the steps again right now. And I'm sure that through that I will have more spiritual awakening. But it's so important to then focus on that second part of this step. You know, a lot of times people will look at this, because this does then involve, sometimes it can involve service work. Sometimes it can, as I said, as we have on here now, go out and pay it forward. And sometimes that's called sponsorship. At times sponsorship is surrogate parenting, where our sponsor can help us to love ourselves until we can do it on our own. Sponsors are not there to tell us how to live our lives. They're there to guide us through the steps and to share their experience, strength, and hope. But also there's, besides sponsorship, which is so needed and so important, a lot of people get afraid to do sponsorship, that they'll run into their codependents, or they'll get afraid to do service work because, they've been giving to everybody and now they're doing service work. But there's a difference between being able to carry the message in some form of service work and being in our codependence. So codependence is fear driven. It is a fear addiction. So whenever we're being relationally through fear, we're in our codependence. When we're able to, as a result of the steps, we've had a spiritual awakening, we're more connected to our higher power, we're coming more from a place of love than fear, and we're able to take that into
our service work, whether that's setting up chairs for a meeting or making coffee or, you know, putting flyers together or, you know, we have a whole group of, you know, from Coda Tucson today that has been doing amazing service work with providing this workshop and inviting us, but they've been doing all the background work on all of this. And it's been tremendous. There's lots of ways to give back. And sometimes we give back, you know, in a way to our families, our friends, by being somebody who is in recovery, who instead of coming from a place of fear, we're coming from a place of love. You know, so it's, there's lots of ways to do this, but I, you know, so encourage people not to be afraid of service work or of sponsorship. You know, and to just kind of jump out there and try it. One of the things I learned about service work for myself, which was pretty impactful, is it kind of held up a mirror to some of the areas that I needed to go back to step one with. And so I grew a lot through it. If I didn't have anything to, you know, kind of bounce it off of, I wouldn't have known where I still needed a little bit more recovery work and where I needed some more healing and some more loving within myself. So I can't say enough about this step. I think it is so important. It is how CODA has continued for almost 35 years now, is through service work, and that it's, you know, and, you know, in a lot of different countries. I've lost, you know, I thought it was around 70 countries. Maybe a little more, a little less, on that. But codependence is a human issue. And again, it's how we, are relational through fear. So whether that's relational with myself, relational with you, relational with my higher power, and it can even go out to relational with Earth, you know, all of that, but how we're relational through fear. So we are going to open up for question and answers, and Ken is going to come back in and join me for this. So that we have plenty of time here to be able, we should be able to take a good 30 minutes to be able to ask questions, or for people to ask questions, and we will give our best answers.
I'm Jack here. A real quick maintenance thing here. If you'd like to have a question, go ahead and click on the lower right. It says raise your hand. And that'll put you in queue to be able to be asked the question. So if you have questions and would like Ken and Mary to help answer them, just click on raise hand down on the bottom and your name will come up as a participant. We already have 3 people's hands raised and we have 97 people participating right now. We had 113 at one time. So thank you, everybody. I'll let them go from there. So it looks like the first hand raised is Yvette. Yvette, would you like to share with us your question?
Awesome. Thank you so much. And thank you especially to Ken and Mary and to the Tucson CODA organization. Thank you so much for this amazing event. I came in about 20 minutes late this morning, and I just really regret that 20 minutes. But anyway, I wanted to ask you, Ken, you had mentioned insight, inspiration, and the two other eyes were what?
Intuition.
I didn't hear that.
Intuition.
Oh.
And instinct.
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 Oh, instinct. Okay, sorry. I don't know why I'm not hearing you well.
No, that's all right. That's all right. And they're experienced. Those are experienced through the heart. You know, some people describe it as my gut instinct, my gut feeling, but it's really directed to our heart, and And it knows far beyond often what our intellectual mind knows or thinks it knows.
Thank you so much. I just need a little clarity on the different parts, the inner child, the loving parent, the adult parent. And were you describing these are different parts of ourselves?
They're parts of our ego state that develop along with us as we develop. They're basically various components of who make up all of what we are, and one of those is always talking to another part of us internally. That's our internal voice, our conversation inside. Who's talking to who?
And just this for the last clarification is the inner parent and the inner adult. Those are two different ego states, apparently.
Oh yeah. The adult is the intellect.
Okay.
The parent is our actions. Do I set boundaries with the child and the teen? Do I set external boundaries? Do I treat myself with love, integrity, adoration? Do I tell that child how much I love and adore him and so grateful that we are one and the same? You know? That's a loving parent rather than a critical, shaming, judgmental, scaring parent.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Yvette. Jordan, you're next. Would you like to ask a question, Jordan?
Yes, I would. Thank you so much, Ken and Mary, for your wonderful presentation. I was wondering about, so I really try to work on self-care and I have really negative self-talk. And I was wondering about, like, sometimes I think I'm doing really well and I feel like I'm really growing in my self-care. And then when, like, periods of stress or, like, I'm really upset about something, I notice that I feel like I go, like, really far backward in, like, how I treat myself. And so I'm wondering if you have any, like, suggestions or ideas on how to kind of, like, build that up more. So when I'm in those periods of, like, intense stress, I'm not, like, feeling like I'm going so far backward, I guess, when I felt like I've made so much growth.
Sure, I'll answer that, and then Ken will probably join in too with that, but there's a really good exercise. So those five areas we've been talking about, the physical, emotional, sexual, spiritual, intellectual, sit down with a piece of paper and just do a mind dump of all the negative, critical, scary ways that you talk to yourself. Write them all down, kind of a dump in that sense, and then take one at a time. And Ken likes to say, write your higher power's highest truth of you in that area. And then you go to the next one and you do the same thing. What is my higher power's highest truth of me in that area? And then you take all those loving affirmations and record them. You know, we're able to do that on our phones. Record them and then listen to them at least twice a day. It takes a little while for our brains to, you know, there's a whole biology in there, but for our brains to create new neural pathways. So you want to make sure you stick with it and listen to them twice a day. If you're in a stressful place, it's a really good thing to listen to, as well as your other tools that you use, but to bring that in. But I did that exercise myself for, pretty consistently for probably the first 7-8 years of my codependence recovery. And then it just sort of, you know, was there. You know, I didn't have to really recreate, you know, work at it so much. What I noticed is the first recording usually lasted about a year, and then I needed to update it. You know, as new things happened, I was starting a new job, different things, you know, I could update it and put new affirmations on there. So
that's a tool that I found really helpful. I don't know if you have anything to add to that. Okay, I did it. Hey. Thank you, Jordan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jordan. Marilyn, you're next.
Excuse me. Hi, this is Marilyn, recovering in Northern California. And I am really grateful for this. It's just fabulous. And I am looking for clarification on step 6. Talked about recognizing the difference and self-monitoring between the imagination and the fantasy. Mm-hmm. So you spoke about, Ken, the imagination versus the fantasy. Mm-hmm. Imagination being the aspect we want to stay in, but I'm kind of clueless here how to differentiate, recognize. Well, if you could elaborate on that.
I'm grateful that you're asking. It's a very good question because they seem very similar. But one of the ways to differentiate would be that imagination comes from the child. I'm sorry. Fantasy is human created. It comes from the child and the teenager. Okay. So it will create a fantasy story about somebody over there and fall in love with them before they ever get close enough to introduce themselves. Imagination is the workshop of the spirit. It's where we get imprint. I've never found a better word for it, but I often experience is I just had something imprinted on my brain. It was an insight, an idea, a thought, a consideration. And it comes through my heart, not through my intellectual mind. Fantasy is a product of my intellectual mind that forces my body to release drugs, just like addiction. And there's 4 fantasy addictions, okay? Well, now there's 4 major fantasy addictions. And first is codependence. The second is love addiction. The third is compulsive gambling. And the fourth is sex addiction. And they're all based on fantasy. And as soon as someone starts a fantasy about a compulsive gambler chasing the wind, and for example, the next win at the tables, a love addict pursuing somebody and creating a fantasy about that person over there, about that, a love relationship with them. And what that does is force the brain to release 3 drugs every time. Dopamine, serotonin, and epinephrine. And when you put those 3 drugs together with at the same time, it goes to the same centers in the brain as cocaine. And so fantasy is the injector of dopamine, serotonin, and epinephrine into the same pleasure centers as cocaine, which then forces the body to release adrenaline. And all of a sudden, we're hired to kite on a fantasy about some target we picked out of. You know, they don't even know it, but we're hired a kite on it. So, and we got ourselves married to them the next 2 weeks, you know, we haven't introduced ourselves, but you know, as I used to hear, I don't hear it much anymore, but early on with COVID, I heard people say, you know, I didn't have relationships. I looked for targets. I held hostages because I needed to hold on to you because you were my fantasy fuel. So you made my fantasies stay alive and I could stay high on the fantasy, but if I'm not high on the fantasies, then I'm going to feel all those feelings, just like any other addiction. And so imagination is a spiritual a process where if I will open my mind through and allow myself to be open to my higher power and imagine, for example, a conversation with my higher power, you know, for a while I had to imagine what my higher power would say to me. I'd ask questions. I'd imagine what my higher power would say in response to those questions. I'd have a conversation. What was my higher power's side of the conversation? And then pretty soon, this voice became real. And I wasn't imagining it anymore because I was having a very real, and I do today, have very real conversations with my higher power, but it was through the vehicle of imagination which opens to the spirit. Is that helpful?
Yes, it's very helpful. And I'm not a much of a medical person. You mentioned three chemicals that help the person like really be drawn to want to do that. Epinephrine was one?
Yeah, dopamine.
Okay.
Serotonin, which is often called the happy drug.
Okay.
Many antidepressants have time release properties that allow serotonin to release into the brain, so it lifts us out of depression periodically through the day. And the third one was epinephrine.
Okay. So that makes this.
Those are the three, and put together at the same time, and the fantasy is really the injector of that. They go to the same pleasure centers in the brain as cocaine and sexual fantasy. So all we need as a fantasy addict is fantasy fuel. The next person to walk in the room might be my target.
Okay.
And so, you know, sex addicts are high on the sexual fantasy. It has little to do with sex. It's all to do with the high of fantasy. And when you put those three drugs together, it then forces the body to release adrenaline. So now I have four intense drugs going on. And what seemed like a horrible day is now an amazing day. Boy, do I feel.
Forces the body to release what?
It forces the body to release adrenaline.
Adrenaline.
So when I've got dopamine, serotonin, adrenaline, epinephrine going out of my body, I feel really good. And if one fantasy department wouldn't work for me, I'd try the other. If I couldn't fantasize about the person being in a relationship with me, I'd fantasize about having sex with them.
Okay.
And that one might work. It might not. But you know, codependents are fantasy addicts. We lived in the fantasy of the you're the one. You're the all. You complete me. I'm nothing without you. We write lots of I love country western music, so I'm not putting it down, but there's a lot of codependent country western music.
Yeah.
And lots of other contemporary, you know, as well. But So it is, but it's all about the fantasy.
Okay.
You know,
you
complete me. You're my happiness. Without you, I'll die. I mean, all of those are, or I've attached this big plug and plugged in Mary, and she needs to fill me up and make me whole. I'm nothing without you. And the fact is, all of those are true, but only with my higher power. Yep. We got to move on.
Thank you.
Okay. How about Nancy from Maui? Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. Aloha.
Aloha.
Thank you so much, Mary and Ken. I'm Nancy, a very grateful recovering codependent. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. My question is about loving myself, which has been a huge project for a very long time, in relationship to narcissistic family members. I had to let my entire family go, and the last one was my sister about a year and a half ago. And my therapist said the choice with narcissists is no contact or minimal contact. And so I've chosen no contact for now, and maybe someday I'll be strong enough to have some kind of minimal contact without it totally breaking my heart, being so despicably treated. But I'm still, you know, she lives in the same apartment building as me, so I pass her now and then, and I've stopped to chat with her a couple of times very briefly, and I'm getting stronger all the time, but there is still some lingering self-hatred that I can't, you know, find some middle ground. I've always lived in the extremes. And I'm hoping someday I could have a minimal contact and be loving toward her and totally accept her as she is and not have it rock my world and just take me down. So anything you could speak on about narcissism, I would be greatly, you know, appreciative.
Yeah, so I guess a part of that, that kind of goes more into our professional life a little bit than 12-step. But what I can talk to in connection, you know, a lot of times when, you know, like with toxic shame, shame, the feeling of shame is about who we are as a person. So toxic shame, we're going to become very self-centered. It can look very similar to some have some narcissistic tendencies to it. So if I'm in a shame attack, it's all about me at that moment. You know, I can put up a shame wall, all that kind of thing. And I can be shameless, deny that shame and be shameless and be offensive to other people, but I'm still in that self-centeredness, but I'm justifying it all. If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So, you know, part of, you know, I had a similar thing with my family. They kicked me out for 17 years, because of me being in recovery. And I would test the waters periodically, you know, call, but I knew that all I was going to do was have a surface relationship. And so I would, if, you know, later on in years, there was contact, but when I would talk to them, I would talk with them about things that I didn't care if the whole world knew. So I kept it on that level, because I knew my boundaries and my internal sense of self was really strong in those areas. And I just would not get vulnerable with them. Mm. You know, I, it's like, you know, I'm vulnerable with safe people. That's part of my self-care. Mm-hmm. And I'm not vulnerable with people I either don't know or I'm not safe with. Mm. And that's just something I do for myself, to take care of myself, and approached it with that. And so I, you know, with my mom, I would do that over and over and over again. And we would, you know, I would call her on the phone after my father had passed. I would call her on the phone and we would chat, but it was just about what was going on in the day. And surprisingly, right before she passed away, she had made amends protecting me with my dad. But it was kind of interesting that I got to my recovery where I didn't need them to show up. Mm-hmm. That need was gone because I was showing up for myself. That need for them to show up was gone. And so they didn't have any power.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that was that the gift of recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And I excuse my language, but I worked my ass off to get to that place. And man, I celebrated it. Yeah.
So thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, that is very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. It looks like Kathy S. is next. Kathy, would you like to ask a question?
Sure. Hold on. I have a million questions. Let me try to focus. Hi, thank you very much for your presentation. I'm Kathy S., and I am clearly a codependent, and I'm new. I have a sponsor who's absolutely wonderful. But we live on opposite sides of the United States, but we meet regularly by phone each week. And so I'm at the beginning and I'm doing the 30 questions, which I find incredibly, like, just complete drudgery and redundant, and it's driving me crazy. But I feel like taking direction at this point. My thing is, like, willingness, obviously. It's like the willingness to do all these fabulous things that were suggested. I seem to have an enormous amount of fear and terror around releasing these survival mechanisms, whether you want to call them character defects, shortcomings, I really don't care what words you use. For me, they're survival mechanisms, and I know I don't have to do them all at once. It's not like I drop the curtain, I drop the scenery, it's a new act, it's a new play, I'm a new character, but it does feel intimidating. And I wonder if you could just speak about willingness and overcoming fear and terror around making these changes.
Willingness, I think, if I'm looking at my survival mechanism, then I like that phrase myself, to be honest with you. Because that's what they were. They were unhealthy ways I learned to try to protect myself. And it was modeled to me. Much of that was modeled to me. But if I look at all of those in a four-step inventory, for example, that can be overwhelming. I mean, seriously overwhelming. So, what can be a different way to do the work is to do all I focus on one at a time. And pick one item that you really want to start working on changing and give it time and attention. Like I said, on the six and seven steps, you know, some people do one of those a day. Some people do one a week. But only, you know, only focus on one, because we can usually be focused on one item that we're working on changing. But if we're going to change it, we need to have the healthy behavior first. Because if I give up a defense mechanism without anything to fall back on as a new behavior, I'm going to feel very lost, and very quickly I'll go right back to what I know, the old behavior. And so you want to create the new behavior first, and then begin to work on letting go of the old behavior so you have the new one to practice. And some of that's just language. It could be, how do I talk to myself in a loving way? You know, being a loving self-parent is like a whole new language. I've had people I've worked with for 20, 30 years. They'll call me out of nowhere and go, yeah, I haven't talked to you in a while, but I'm doing really well in most of the areas of my life. But I got this one area, and for the life of me, I can't think of how to say it as a loving, empowered parent. You know, and so I may offer them some suggestions, and they go, oh, that's all I needed, thanks. And they could internalize it. But we didn't grow up learning this language, and it's not easy at first, and it just takes practice. I tell people, and I tell myself, time is my best friend. And if I take my time and not try to force the process and allow my higher power to let it to present to me and move me through the process, and my higher power's time is far more graceful than if I'm trying to force something to change that probably may not be ready to change it. And I've done that. I've forced myself to change, not strengthen the behavior yet. Didn't turn out well. So keeping it simple, one item at a time to look out rather than all the defense mechanisms, I think it can be very helpful.
Your opinion then with regard to his ability to appreciate the wrongfulness of his conduct on September 15, 2001, specifically the period of that, and then say 2:40 to 3:00.
Thank you, Kathy. Whoever's talking, could you please mute? And I think Colin is next. Kathy, were you finished?
I feel like I got information, but I didn't get a sense. Maybe Mary can speak to some of the fear or terror around change that stops the willingness.
You can, or I can, but we have to intervene on the fear and thoughts and replace those as well. If I don't, they're just going to play out because that's habit.
Yeah, I don't know that I would add much more to that. It, you know, there is that, you know, that kind of like inner discipline to be willing to intervene on those thoughts like Kim's talking about. Because our thoughts create our feelings. So if we keep thinking the same old thoughts, we're going to have the same old feelings, which means we're going to probably have the same old behaviors. Going back, being on those beginning thoughts that are playing a part with whatever survival behavior you're trying to change, that is so important. And the exercise that I give, the negative and messages and the affirmations, is helpful.
Okay, thanks. And thanks for the guided imagery.
You're welcome.
Okay, Colin, you're next. Would you like to share a question?
Yes, thank you. Hi, Ken and Mary. I'm Colin. I'm from Maryland. It was nice to meet you.
Hi, Colin.
Thanks very much for your sharing. Kind of nervous even now talking to you. But what I was going to say, I was just asking for a small bit of guidance. Like I'm like going to court a couple of months now. I kind of dedicated myself to it. I got into, I was adopted after a few weeks old, and I met my biological mother when I was 27, 28. And when I met her, I just got very enmeshed and became very codependent on her. And I got really hurt the last 2 or 3 years because I made myself vulnerable a lot, and, it wasn't safe, basically. A lot of what Mary was saying is just really resonated with me about, not being vulnerable with people who aren't safe. Took me a long time to realize that she wasn't for me. But I went to CODA anyway, and I've tried the steps a couple of times. I've done it in AA as well. And the message that keeps coming back to me with sponsors is I haven't surrendered. And I find with sponsors, I get triggered a lot. And I'm going to counseling at the moment. I'm getting help with kind of doing that vulnerable part of me. And I think I heard, Mary, before you were sharing about, I think it was counseling that helped you to do the step one or something to surrender. So basically, I'm not trying to, like, my thing is, like, I can get caught up in trying to figure out the whole thing too much, and, like Ken was saying, like, forcing it too much. So at the moment, I'm actually, like, taking a break from, like, steps and all that, because I think I've been pushing too hard. That's kind of me trying to fix myself type of thing. So I don't know if you have any experience in what I've just spoke about, but do you have any kind of suggestions on kind of surrendering the first step and kind of the whole process with sponsors and feeling safe with the right person? And obviously for me, trust is a big thing as well. I find it hard to just kind of do this military style kind of steps, but not be able to kind of feel safe with the person, because I'm always like kind of, I'm always afraid of being shamed or kind of ridiculed and stuff, you know? So, just wanted to throw that out to you. If you have any suggestions on my experience.
So what I can say just on, because there are a few pieces in there, but around the sponsorship of always knowing that, sponsors aren't there to shame us or tell us how to live our lives or what we're doing wrong. And sometimes, because there is that aspect of codependence where I'm going to tell people how to do their lives. So I would really pay attention to maybe the language of your sponsor to, really listen to that. If that is language that is harmful, maybe talking to your sponsor, there's some communication pamphlets that CODA has, using some of those to communicate to your sponsor about how they're talking to you, to see if there might be able to be some healing and change there. And if not, get another sponsor. Bottom line, it's so important. We were all wounded, or we wouldn't be in CODA. And so it's so important to have safe people around us that will hear us and listen to us and guide us. So I don't know if you had anything. Okay. Is that helpful?
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Colin. It looks like Galaxy A10E is next. Do you have a question? Galaxy, are you still with us? Do you want to ask a question? Okay, we'll move on to Ksenia. Do you have a question you want to ask Ken and Mary?
Yes, thank you. First of all, much gratitude to our founders. Is Galaxy back with us? Would they like
yes,
to turn?
Yes, I was doing a chat and I had a trouble getting back to you.
Well, go ahead then.
Okay, well, first of all, I don't know why it came up Galaxy, but my name's Sandy. My question is, Mary, when you were talking about what does the question about whose voice does your higher power have, I got first I said my daughter, and then I got when we came to the question about describe a loving power from where you can turn to that you trust, I started, as I was writing my answer to that one, it's like, but I trust my daughter. I love my daughter. Sometimes she's patient, sometimes she's not. Sometimes she's understanding, sometimes she's not. And then I got, well, maybe it's not my daughter because all the characteristics I wrote don't fit. And then I thought about a roommate I had that I did make my higher power for a long time and I was miserable, but finally I realized to let her go. And then at the end it was, I don't know, or is it me? Do I make myself my higher power? So I'm just really confused about that. I was wondering what you had to say about that.
Well, one is I would create maybe characteristics of your loving higher power that are, it may draw on positive things you've had with other people, but to look more at what you would like a loving higher power to be that's separate from others. You know, because other people will always let us down. You know, I let myself down, you know, and so that's just an idea I would suggest is maybe sitting down and doing that. But, you may like, you know, like the quality of patience and love and somebody who hears you. But to work at disconnecting that out from any people, instead maybe taking those positive characteristics and focusing that on how you see your higher power.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, Ksenia, would you like to share now? Thank you, Sandy.
Sure. And woohoo, I get to share second dose of gratitude to Ken and Mary. Thank you, thank you, thank you for your wonderful experience, your amazing strength, and all the hope you give to me and many others. And I actually had a somewhat easy request. In the beginning of the workshop, there was a diagram that showed the side of health and who is inside with loving child, teen, loving parent, and loving adult, and so on. And the part about unmanageability and codependent adaptation was left blank. I suppose I could deduce it from reading a lot of notes I took, but to make it quick and easy, may I ask for counterparts that would go on the diagram?
Yes, I could give them to you quickly. Instead of the loving child, it would be the passive, aggressive, adaptive child. The passive roles are the good-looking roles, and the aggressive roles are the rebellion roles. Like, one of my roles was the problem in the family. And we adapt to the environment. The parent is indulgent and or critical parent. Now, the adult was fear and shame thoughts instead of loving thoughts. And the higher self was the loving higher self, the adaptive, was a diminishing heart.
And thank you.
Most of us, we grew up in what, with most of those in degrees, some very extreme, some not, and a lot of us in the gray zones in between.
That ties it up in the bow nicely. I appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
I can do that.
Ken and Mary, do you have time for a few more, or do you want to wrap it up? What would you like to do?
We can take a couple more.
We'll stay on for a while.
Okay, well, thank you, Ksenia. How about Charlotte? Would you like to ask a question?
Oh, hi there. Yes, thank you. Thank you so much, Ken and Mary. It's been a real incredible experience to hear you and do the exercises, and I've taken a lot of notes. And I think what you were saying, well, the exercise with the higher power really helped me. I think the past 2 weeks I've been very superstitious and fearful and anxious, and you know, I guess the punishing, vengeful, scary higher power has really been what I've been trying to appease in my mind. And I think I, in writing the exercise about parents, you know, my both parents were quite distant and then explosive, but the way I could always get my father's attention was by achieving, and work and achievement has always been like a suit of armor. But then that makes me get fearful about it and superstitious, and that it's going to be taken away. And I just have been, I guess, incredibly anxious about that. And also, I guess, accepting life on life's terms. Sometimes, you know, obviously we encounter and meet other dysfunctional people. And I think it's just, the past 2 weeks, I feel like whenever something good happens, I'm going to be punished and something's going to happen. And I can't allow myself to be happy or to, and it's just this negative knot in my mind of like a conspiracy of impending doom. So I don't know exactly what the question is. The exercises have really helped, and the idea of writing down the truth my higher power sees in me in affirmations is something I'm going to do this weekend. But if you had anything further to add to that, that'd be great. And if not, I just want to thank you so much. It's been an incredible afternoon, and I've been listening from the UK.
Oh, wonderful.
Thank you. You know, I think starting out, you know, just to keep it very simple, you know, there's lots of, you know, you could look for inspirational books as well that are there. But starting out with just writing out your characteristics for your higher, loving higher power, doing that exercise that I talked about in there, separated it out from your major, you know, the major authority figures, but then really taking, you know, Ken was talking about in the 11th step, you know, how much time do we spend with our higher power compared to developing relationships with others, and really take some time to develop that relationship, with your higher power of your understanding. I would just keep it simple and practice that till you really feel that in your heart.
Thank you. That's really helpful. Thank you both so much.
Yeah, well, thank you, Charlotte.
One of the things that I found helpful for me to keep it somewhat simple was that my higher power, characteristics of my higher power, is the only place that I allow absolutes. So, for example, one of the characteristics is my higher power is always present.
Yeah, I love that.
My higher power absolutely loves and adores me no matter what. My higher power gives me the room and flexibility to make the mistakes so I can learn and grow and evolve. Those are the types of things that help me take it out of the human realm.
Thank you so much. That's wonderful.
Thank you, Charlotte. How about Melanie F? Would you like to ask a question?
Hi. Yes. Thank you so much, Ken and Mary. This has been absolutely amazing. I've done the steps in AA before, but like this is just taken it to the next level. And I really think that codependence is my issue. Like the whole time that you're presenting, I was having these healing tears. Like it was just, I could relate to everything. And it's what I'm missing. So lately I've been at work and I've been really hardcore on myself, thinking I don't know enough. I'm not good enough as the other people. It's a new job. And all these critical voices that you're talking about is out there. And I'm just wondering, like, in terms of the selves, like, would I be there when I'm at work, like, trying to talk to my selves in that loving way? Like, do I talk to the teen if I see that teen coming out? Do I talk to that child if I see that child coming out? And the, I'm not sure how to distinguish the parent and the adult so much, but I'm going to go back over this and listen. But like, I'm just wondering, is that like, is myself all of those selves? And like, yeah, I'll leave it there.
All of those selves make up who we are. Okay. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, each part, the child, the teen, the parent, the adult, the higher self, all have different language. They have a different voice. They have different handwriting. And no, we're not schizophrenic or multiple personalities, other than we do have different components that should have integrated the child into the teen into the adult into the higher self, or the parent of the adult and the higher self. Had we done that, we would be what they call a whole brain thinker. And we would feel whole. So when we don't, we go find somebody to attach to fill up the empty places. So for example, Mary would be playful and delightful little girl, and I would use that as my child. She might use me as her parent, because we all, to feel whole, we need to have a child, parent, adult, and higher self. So we'll find people to fill me into places. And I also found it helpful. Yes, I would say talk to that child and that teen anywhere, anytime.
Okay. And I'm just wondering, like you said earlier, a definition of ego and like a simple definition of codependence. I remember Mary said a couple of simple things, because I've read books and there's like, it goes on and on and on about characteristics and stuff. So can you remember what you said about ego? You said a definition of ego and codependence. This is Ken said.
Yeah. So, you know, part of, you know, I'm big on keeping things simplified, because it is, codependence can get very complicated, in a sense. But, so I see it as a way that we are relational through fear. So whether that's how I'm relational with myself or relational with Ken or you or anybody else, you know, because codependence is a fear addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but it's about how we're relational through that fear.
And there's something about the ego is something until it turns into fear, I heard.
Ego, probably the simplest definition of ego is what I think I am.
Okay.
So egotistical, self-centered, maybe arrogant folks really think they're hot stuff, you know? And ego can change any time during the day based on where we're at emotionally. If we've got some shame going on, our ego tends to drop into the toilet. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not enough. Or if I got some fear going on, I might get little. In my case, mm-hmm. I didn't do little. I would go to the other extreme. I compensated with feeling weak and small and little and insignificant by being big and puffy and arrogant, you know, and sometimes rageful or whatever, because that gave me a false sense of power, where the fact is I really grew up feeling powerless. Absolutely powerless. And codependence to me is that I attach my sense of well-being, my happiness, my joy, my value, my worth to another human being. That's half codependence. The other half is I avoid, we're either enmeshed and attached to another human being, or we avoid, both based on fear. I will avoid other human beings, and I won't let anybody get too close out of the fear that I'm going to be hurt or shamed or judged or criticized or put down one more time or or whatever. So that we call those avoidant. But the term codependence came out of the 1960s and 70s, compulsively depending upon, which is a mental health term, by the way, compulsively depending upon another human being for my value, my worth, and my identity.
Thank you so much. Oh my goodness. Thank you. I love this. And like just for sponsorship and meetings, like, is there like really help? Like, how do you go about finding the solution focused ones and a sponsor? I find this program very difficult to find a sponsor, but this is the last question. And, but in AA, they're everywhere, but it's very difficult to get them here and like to find like really solution focused meetings like this. Is there any like a list or?
So there, you know, I don't know if you're in Arizona or not, or, you know, but I know in Arizona, I believe Tucson does, and I believe the website for CODA does, have a list, you know, where you can find, people for sponsorship. Some people will, you know, like I sponsor somebody in California. Yeah, no. I mean, a lot of times somebody shared earlier their sponsors across the country. So, you know, sponsorship has been done differently, in CODA, you know, because there weren't any old timers when we started out. You know, we were all babies. And so we would co-sponsor each other. You know, we'd get one or two, you know, two of us or three of us maybe together and work the steps together. Kind of thing. So CODA Tucson, like this, they do these kinds of workshops regularly. The Arizona Events Committee does workshops regularly. There's meetings in California that do work. You know, there's, so you can go on the national website, CODA.org, and there should be some information about workshops, but you can also get the meeting list, and the meetings will usually show, like if it's a steps group or if it's, you know, just like in AA, you know, if it's a specific kind of meeting that's, you know, where you'll get some more solution.
All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Should we go ahead and close or do you want to? Yeah. Okay. It's great. It's time to close. So, yeah, Sarah put in on the chat down at the bottom the seventh tradition stating that every CODA group ought to be self-supporting, and you can pay via PayPal or Venmo. We'd love for you to support that. Also, Jeannie said that she would read the 12 promises for us. Jeannie, do you have those for us? Well, I can read them. So, all right. The 12 promises of Codependence Anonymous. I can expect a miraculous change in my life by working the program of Codependence Anonymous. As I make an honest effort to work the 12 steps and follow the 12 traditions, 1, I know a new sense of belonging. The feeling of emptiness and loneliness will disappear. 2, I am no longer controlled by my fears. I overcome my fears and act with courage, integrity, and dignity. 3, I know a new freedom. 4, I release myself from worry, guilt, and regret about my past and present. I am aware enough not to repeat it. 5, I know a new love and acceptance of myself and others. I feel genuinely lovable, loving, and loved. 6, I learn to see myself as equal to others. My new and renewed relationships are all with equal partners. 7, I am capable of developing and maintaining healthy and loving relationships. The need to control and manipulate others will disappear as I learn to trust those who are trustworthy. 8, I learn that it is possible to mend, to become more loving, intimate, and supportive. I have the choice of communicating with my family in a way which is safe for me and respectful of them. 9, I acknowledge that I am a unique and precious creation. 10, I no longer need to rely solely on others to provide my sense of worth. 11, I trust the guidance I receive from my higher power and come to believe in my own capabilities. And 12, I gradually experience serenity, strength, and spiritual growth in my daily life. And so, I would like to thank Ken and Mary again and everyone for attending. Oh my gosh, what a wonderful, awesome workshop to learn so much about recovery and our inner selves from Ken and Mary, and how to detach from the dysfunction and learn to live in the recovery mode. Like my first co-sponsor used to say, living through the lenses of recovery. So fabulous to learn more about the early childhood and growth of Ken and Mary as they shared with us. And thanks to all the people who participated, we had as many as 116 people, it looked like, on the participants. And thank you for all the people who had questions. So without further ado, we'll close with the closing prayer and serenity prayer. Please remain on mute and follow along with me. The code in closing prayer says, we thank our higher power for all we have received from this meeting. As we close, may we take with us the wisdom, love, and acceptance and hope of recovery. And the serenity prayer says, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Keep coming back. It works if you work it, and you're worth it. And you got to work it every day. Amen.
Yep. Thank you.
And Jack, we wanted to thank all of you in Tucson for all the work you guys have done to put this workshop on. It's been amazing. Thank you so much.
Thanks for Sarah and Leisha and everybody and Chris, and everybody who put this together. And thank you for wanting to do it and sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.